If you lost Big Brother and you're feeling down, David and Jessica will turn it around. They'll break down the rules and they'll show you how. You played yourself and got voted out. This is why Blank lost. And this is why Blank lost. Oh baby, this is why Blank lost.
Welcome to another edition of Why Blank Lost. I'm David Bloomberg, and last week on this very podcast, I predicted that the three evictees in the triple would be Kevin, David, and Danny.
Yay.
I'm clearly brilliant, and it wasn't at all an obvious prediction. I am clearly brilliant.
Oh, look at you, big-headed and all.
That's right. Now, joining me, as always, is my final two ally.
Yay!
Who I swear I will never turn on.
Aww. Really? You
Jessica
mean that?
Lewis.
You really mean that?
Sure. Yes. I absolutely mean
such
that as far
a,
as
such
you know.
An empty promise they all made.
Yes. Yes. And our guest today is someone whose name may be familiar to those of you who used to follow me back in my Reality News Online website days. A guy who used to do a ton of Big Brother coverage, Bill Hammond.
Oh, time to plant some seeds.
Yes.
Oh, now, God, this is awesome.
Well, now, I just feel for you because you've clearly been dealing with David much longer than I've been dealing with David. So I could learn a few things from you, Bill.
Well, here's the thing. I've known David for going on 12 years now. I started working for him covering the Big Brother feeds back in season 9, which... Let's muse about the fact that we now have two previous winners to lose income due to mocking the autistic.
Yes.
But I did not meet David in person until earlier this year when he came to Los Angeles for the Winners at War premiere.
Really?
He and I have known each other for more than a decade, but this is the first time we've ever been in the same place.
That's fascinating.
Which
Look
was approximately
that.
The last time anyone was allowed to be in the same place.
I know,
place.
Pretty
right?
much, yeah.
Unless and, I won't go there.
Yeah. And I will brown nose for half a second here because I was mildly disappointed, Jessica, that you couldn't make it because you were my winner pick.
Oh, I'm
you
so
were
sorry.
My that rock broke my goddamn heart.
It broke mine too in so yeah. many places and so many people in my family's hearts were broken.
I have such bad luck picking winners on Survivor. I mean, what was it? I think Gabon
Me
was
too?
The first time Gabon was the first time I participated in the R&O roundtable, and the one I picked to win went out first. So
it was a crushing moment. I appreciate you for picking me, though. Thank you. That's always nice to hear.
I thought it was a lock. I thought it was a lock. Even the edit didn't betray what was about to happen. I was like, I felt good about this. No, and then
Listen, I felt good about it when the game started. When I was like. This is going very, very well. I was feeling good about myself, and then the goddamn rocks happened. Person on Twitter, take a drink, because we have a listener that's like, take a drink every time rocks get brought up on Live Lang Lost.
Oh,
so that's our new drinking game. So there you go. Yeah.
I don't think I'll there's ever been a...
Hold on, let's get them plastered. Rock, 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 rock. Yeah.
I don't think there's ever been a rock draw that has resulted in the person we wanted leaving.
Yeah, yeah.
I appreciate that, though. Thank you. Yeah. that was a tough one. But you know what, though? You and I can commiserate because David can attest to my inability to pick a winner. I've only ever done it once, and it was years ago. I picked JT.
And we only have her word for it. So
I know, but you can ask my husband. He would agree that, yes, I did it once, and I've been terrible at it ever since. It's like the one time I got it right, and every other time they get sent home, like, very, very early. Unless there's an ability to come back into the game, and then there's a fire-making challenge that gets you knocked out. So, sorry, Rick Evans, that was you.
I think Ethan was the only winner I ever correctly picked. So
wow, so that's going way back. Oh my goodness, yeah.
Right. I've picked so many I can't even remember.
Oh,
so.
I've come close a few times. I've come close a few times, but Ethan's the only winner I've picked.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, Bill. David, you can relax a little bit, okay? Goodness.
Yeah. Now, for anyone used to. Seeing Bill's work in print, obviously, you can look at his Twitter handle there. He went by William on Reality News Online. And he was as close to my version of Taron Armstrong as you can get. Because Bill recapped most of the live feeds. So the Reality News Online readers had that day's live feed summary ready when they got to work each morning.
Amazing.
Because let's face it, that's when most people were reading the website. Mm. I saw the stats. It wasn't before work. It wasn't after work. It was during work. We know. Also, Bill wrote other columns, like looking at which house guests were acting the craziest each week.
The old BPI rankings.
Yes, yes. So, he covered a ton of Big Brother. And it's safe to say Reality News Online Big Brother coverage would not have been anywhere near as good without him.
Aw, that's awesome.
He introduced me to Rob at the Winners of War premiere as his Taron, and there's almost no higher praise I could have gotten. listening to the live feed recaps the last week, I live for Taron's impersonation of Enzo now. And back in the day, I was working at ESPN at the time when I was still living on the East Coast, and that made for a lot of late nights. It was typical for me to get out of work at 2-3 in the morning. So that was about the time that things were wrapping up in the Big Brother house each week. So I could come home. I lived like two blocks from the campus. I would come home. I would fire up the feeds for whatever happened late night. And then just read all the recaps, all the message board posts, type everything up in about 2 hours. And then posted to David around 5 a.m. before going to sleep for the night.
God. So
and then get
David,
and then get
you
up,
were like a slave driver.
And then get up at like 2 in the afternoon to hit the gym before going to work. So in a weird way, it actually kind of fit into my schedule perfectly at the time.
It sounds like a hell of a schedule to keep. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I was 25 at the time. I could handle it.
Yeah. And then I would wake up a little bit after he went to bed, you know, at like 5:30 or so, and start editing and posting articles. So
unreal. It's very a lot of dedication there for sure. So,
yeah,
just the fact that we had to start with season 9, like, oh, God, what did I get into?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Well, and I feel like I don't know how Taron does anything else but watch the live feeds. I mean, what else
does
he
do? I'm not sure.
Right.
He does.
I mean, that's all he has to be doing. And because he's recording so many times a week and there's so much material. I have a hard time just keeping up with what we're doing. I mean, that's crazy. So kudos to him. And kudos to you, Bill, for doing basically the same thing.
I guess I'll take a little bit of humble brag that I had to type it all. I couldn't just do it in a half hour podcast.
That's true. That is true. But you should brag about it. That's very dedicated right there.
It was one of the coolest moments, times of my life being part of the RNO family. Whether it was covering Big Brother, Survivor, The Mole, Biggest Loser, like all of those shows, it took my love of the genre and put it to a use that I didn't even think was possible. So, and then
so
now
nice.
it's evolved into this kind of stuff, and I couldn't be happier. So
nice, and here you are.
That's
exactly.
Right. Yeah. So Bill was actually doing a podcast before I knew anything about podcasts. I don't even remember what it was about, but I know you started doing one and then people were like, hey, David, Reality News Online should have a podcast. And I'm like, podcasts.
Yeah. It was called The Reality Rant, which anybody who read my stuff on RNO knows I can go on a tangent and diatribe for paragraphs and pages on end. So it only seemed natural. My roommate and I did it for about 3 years, and for a little while we got some traction. Like if you like actually search iTunes for like reality TV podcast, there was the reality TV podcast, and then we were like 20th ranked, and then this was about a year before Rob started doing his podcast, so we didn't know if it ever could take off or not. So the main reality TV podcast was really the main event. And then everybody else kind of had their side things or their minor ones. We kept it going for, like I said, about 3 years. My best friend Eric moved out here in 2011. That made things a whole lot harder. We kept it going for about another year after that. And then 2014, I moved in with him. So,
wow.
So
very nice. Look at that.
We decided not to revive the podcast, but we started working in game and reality TV. So it was a bit of its own little adventure. So,
Well, that's great when you can work inside of something that you love so much. So that's exactly great for you. A lot of people don't get to do that.
All right. So now that we have relived all those years and brought people up to speed.
That's right.
Yes. It is time to talk about the three evictees. And in some ways, it seems anticlimactic for two of them because we've known Kevin and David weren't long for this game for a while now. I mean, for one thing, they're not white, which, you know, as we've talked about before, was a severe hindrance this season. But spoiler alert, they weren't exactly superstar players either. Mm-hmm. In any case, whenever we have a situation like this where we have to cover multiple players, like in the Survivor finale where we have to discuss six people, we unfortunately aren't going to get quite as in-depth. I mean, last week we spent 2 hours primarily talking about Davon with Adam Klein last week. We don't plan on this being a 6-hour podcast.
No. No, we don't. No. We really don't.
We'd be getting into those hours that Bill was just describing.
Right.
And if there's one thing that's happened this season, it's everything goes according to plan.
Yes. Absolutely.
That is true.
Oh, wait, where's my banner behind me saying triple eviction?
We have to talk about that for just a second, because that was amazing when that went down, because the look on Cody's face was incredible when he saw that. And the fact that Julie was clearly very angry, but was trying to maintain her composure, was hysterical. I thought it was so much fun to be experiencing that with them.
I mean, the whole thing was foolish to even try to keep it a secret, because the Will appearance all but gave it away, and everybody figured it out within moments, to the point where people were complaining on Twitter, like, how could you tell them? Why did you tell them?
Yeah.
But I've worked in sports, I've worked in news, and we have a saying, and it's called live television.
Mm-hmm.
Though this episode was technically not live, it was recorded slightly earlier in the day, but it was recorded what we call live to tape, so as if it was a live show. Mm-hmm. And these things just happen. I mean, it's the same thing with the have not door opening on opening night. No matter what you plan for in a live broadcast, there is always some Murphy's Law randomness that's going to happen, and you have to just sit back and laugh at it when it happens. And that's what I did, because I knew it was, like, you know, best laid plans of mice and men, even though it was silly to even try to keep up the charade in the first place. As soon as I saw it, like, you gotta be kidding me.
It was so
television.
Yeah. The best part was, it was right after she says, we're going to keep it a secret from them just a little longer.
And then Cody
goes
face.
Live, and there it is.
And there's Cody.
Across the screen.
Yeah. It was so good. It was
Memphis's
so good.
Jaw just drops, even though they already knew.
It was amazing. That was so much fun to watch. So, and then, sorry, and then
for Nicole and David to use that in their exit speech. That had to be salt in the wound for the production there.
Twist it a little bit there.
And then, and then Julie, when she's interviewing David, I didn't say anything about a triple eviction.
That was my favorite.
Oh, God.
I didn't say anything yet. Yeah.
I mean, unintentionally, easily one of the top five entertaining moments of the season.
That was
up there for sure. And I have to say, I much prefer the game moving this fast. It was so much more fun to watch, because it gave them so much less time to figure stuff out. A lot can happen in a week, right? And a lot of boring things can happen in a week, and a lot of the same routine can happen in a week. So to really speed things up like this, I thought it was much more enjoyable. I loved it. I thought it was great that they were like, let's get rid of three of them right now, and let's do this and move it along. I thought it was wonderful.
That was my thought as well, until they told them.
I mean,
because the fun of a double eviction, even though they happen usually twice per season, and the players do kind of put in contingency plans and try to work their way around them, the fun of those episodes is when you have to instantly scramble and talk to people in and out of the commercial breaks, in whatever room you can duck into. And for the most part, we were robbed of that, because they knew that we got a little bit of it. But when Memphis won HOH, it's like, he doesn't need to talk to anybody. He knows exactly what he's going to do. He's already put in every single bit of the pecking order. He's already figured out everything he's going to do because they knew for about 3 days. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, tragic misuse of Will Kirby. Good God.
Oh, gosh. Yes. Or lack of use. Yeah. I mean, all the promotion. They have a neighbor moving in next door. Oh, my gosh. And then they use him for two little tiny clips.
Yeah. My daughter was so funny. She was watching the competition when they were asking all of the questions about him. And she had kind of been listening, but not really, because she was doing something else. And as she's watching them ask these questions, she's like, how on earth are they supposed to remember any of the stuff from season two? And then I had to explain to her, I'm like, no, this actually just happened. Like, it happened like this season. Okay. But it would have been
more interesting if they had done. I thought when they said Dr. Will trivia, I'm like, yes, they're going to do trivia from when he played.
And then this is like, actual game stuff. Is he wearing slippers? Did he wink more than one time? Like, I was like, really? Come on.
I mean, unfortunately, if they were truly to ask trivia about when Will played, they would have to kind of go back on their leitmotif of only comps matter. So, because Will won season two and he almost won season seven without winning a single competition.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the first time when there was no Vito to save him. He was on the block, I think, what, six times? Seven times? Something. I mean, it became so cliche by the end that Nicole, who he was up against in the final two, didn't even get credit for putting him up when she did, because it just became a running gag.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, but yeah, he never needed a single competition to save him. He never needed a single competition to manipulate that game. That's why he's the greatest of all time. And I got some mild hope early in the season when Ian was referencing that. But of course, Ian never was in the majority, so it didn't matter.
Yeah.
So, should note for anyone who's new to this podcast, as you're now 15 minutes in, each week, We chat, but we also look at the player, or in this case, players, who got evicted and analyze his, her, or their gameplay using what we saw on TV, live feeds, interviews, other information, such as articles I wrote way back in the original season, as is the case for Kevin and Danny this week. We compare everything about their game to a set of guiding rules I originally wrote in 2004 and have modified since, including the most recent version at robhasawebsite.com/bigbrotherrules. Now, under normal circumstances, we would discuss a few more things. I don't know if you guys have anything more to discuss. Considering this was a triple eviction, obviously there's not a whole lot to say for the last two because it all, you know, happened so quick.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Is there anything else either of you want to discuss before we get to the rules?
I don't think so. I appreciate the pace. We talked about that, but again, it was a little bit spoiled. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is, we've gone over this many times. This has been a disappointing season. Part of it because of the racial undertones at best, and the other part due to the lack of gameplay and moves. I mean, I think at this point I've counted, three definite moves over the course of the season. I'll even say four. Memphis forming the alliance. Kacer playing the safety suite. Davon playing the veto on Kevin. And then Danny and Nicole flipping the script on Ian. When I say a move, I'm talking about something that actually changes the course of the game. You can always say that, yeah, the alliance is making moves by sticking together and holding the line. Right. But what I'm talking about is, especially in a game like Big Brother, where you're in such close quarters the entire time and you know, you can't walk away. You can't even, you know, as we saw with Nicole, you can't even go to the bathroom undisturbed.
Well, you can, if you lock the door, you know,
I mean, terrible joke alert. I just love the fact that we had a golf competition, then we saw Enzo's putts. So, on this game, it's like what I consider a move is something that changes the course. Something that it doesn't have to be grandiose. It doesn't have to be a Dan's funeral or something like that. Just something that if we're going down this path, skew it just a little bit.
Mm.
And that's only happened at most four times. You know, I've taken to calling this the Duke Kaboom of seasons in reference to the Toy Story character, because it's like that gift you got on Christmas that you saw all the commercials for and it was all super hyped and super awesome, and then you played with it and it's a dud. It's like
appropriate.
That's how I see
there.
This season.
And I do think that this is worth mentioning because you talked about the Alliance of Six, and I want to give them credit because obviously they've been sticking together and they've been deciding
not anymore,
but up to this point, deciding the course of the game. And so, yes, you have to give them credit for coming together and doing that. But I do think that one thing that gets lost on individuals who watch the game is that at some point those six do have to turn on each other, and you really have to start taking stock of where do you fall within that group of six. And that was a situation I found myself in. I knew exactly where I was in that group of six, and it was not in a good place. And so if you know that you are the low man on the totem pole in that group of six, you have to start thinking outside the box, because do you want to finish sixth? Is that where you're happy with, or do you want to try to win the game? And I know David is a very big proponent on talking about this. You are there to win the game. Mm-hmm. You're not there to finish sixth. You're not there to finish fifth. So anything that you do has to elevate where you end up ending at the end of the game, and that is in the winning position. And so that seems to be the part they're all kind of missing, is that they're of the six, where do you fall? And I think Danny was trying to maneuver and figure that out, but we'll talk about Danny, well, obviously. Yeah. I won't jump ahead.
Now, Bill, I do have to say, before we get to the rules, I hate to shoot down your move thing, but two of them were comp related.
Yep.
And the Memphis one, really, I mean, I know, yeah, I guess technically Memphis did it, but that group was already together. It was just pretty much adding himself to it.
Mm. Yeah, you see this? It's a straw. I'm clutching at it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find anything. Because this is the thing. It's like, you know, it's like I love this show. I love this game. And when it's on point, this is one of the best shows on TV. I've interviewed to be on this show. I've interviewed to work on this show. I know some people in some higher up positions, or at least through second or third degree relationships. When I criticize this show, it is done purely out of love, because I know how great this can be. Mm. Not just from a TV production standpoint, but just as a fan. I mean, watching you guys the first week, you know, just watch you guys talk to Ronnie. That was a special thing for me, because the first time I tried out for Big Brother, it was for season 11, and I got a call back. I got interviewed for that season. And then when it finally aired, I was like, oh my God, I was going to be Ronnie.
That's incredible.
based on the high school clicks and everything, like, if I had gotten picked, I would have taken Ronnie's spot. So I have some special affection for that season, even though it didn't turn out the way I would have preferred. You know, even though I would not have played the same game as Ronnie, mostly because I fell in love with Lydia on day one and probably would have gotten myself into major trouble as being part of a pair. And I would have just hung out with Lydia, Kevin, and Michelle the entire time. But it's like there's such special affection for that season for me. So it's like, and that's where that's part of the whole love of the show. So it's like, I don't have any kids. I know you guys do, but it feels like being a parent's like, I know you're capable of so much more, and I'm not, and you're just, it's like, I want to just push you to be better. So right. It's like, because I know there's so much good stuff that this show has given us over the years. And now it's kind of devolved in this whole thing where even 2 years ago when Tyler played the first time, the whole level six, The game has shifted so far toward comps that it's like, okay, we get an alliance of six of all comp beasts, and we just run the table.
Yeah.
Back in the RNO days, David and I discussed this many, many times about how you can't just rely on comps, because eventually you're going to lose and you're going to be on the defensive. Well, they've now beaten that aspect because they're never on the defensive.
Right.
And if they are, we're talking in a situation like going into this triple eviction where it was six against three. Mm-hmm. You know, if Kevin had somehow won HOH going into this week instead of Cody, what difference would it have made in the long run? Like he could take his shot at Cody if he wanted to. He could have taken a shot at Nicole, whatever. It doesn't upset the balance even in the slightest. Whereas in the best seasons of this show, we're talking season 10, season 12, these alliances are willing to take hits. They have pecking orders. Even the strongest alliances, like the Brigade, they knew that Matt was expendable. They knew they always had someone that they knew they could get rid of once the tables turned, because they had to.
Right.
And now we're in a situation where the tables no longer have to turn based on whatever arbitrary criteria we make up. It's just run the table, run the comps, and run out of the house.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then so. Pick people off from there. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into our three evictees here. We knew that Kevin and David were the final targets of the committee. But what put them in that position? Was there anything they could have done about it, either earlier in the game or at this later date? Dani was a member of that alliance and thought she was in a very secure spot. Where did she go wrong? When Cody won HOH, Kevin figured he'd be nominated and asked himself, how did I find myself in this situation? We'll answer that question, not just for him, but for the other two as well. It's time to figure out why Kevin, David, and Dani lost.
Woohoo!
Yes. All right. So we get to rule one, and we're 25 minutes in.
I know.
They've been a fun 25 minutes.
They have been.
So the first and most important rule, of course, is to scheme and plot. I would say that all three players, to varying degrees, understood the need to do this. The difference was in the range of their abilities to do so. Back when Kevin was originally on Big Brother 11, I interviewed him and noted that it seemed he understood that, you know, it didn't matter what promise he made. This was a game. He could go back on anything he said. He told his boyfriend, who is now his husband, that he would swear to everything because he knew he was on a game show set. It might look like a house, but it's a game show set. And indeed, in my original Why Kevin Lost article from the time, I said he knew he had to tell lies in order to play the game, and he was fairly good at it. If he had to break a promise, he did. If he had to swear on his boyfriend, his life, anything, he did. I just want to know where that Kevin was. I know it's been over a decade, but that's the Kevin that we wanted and needed to see.
Mm-hmm. He did seem very complacent, and it was unfortunate because he always seemed to be like the, well, we can just put Kevin up. You know, he was like the fallback guy, and I know he liked to call himself the pawn, but that's not the position that you want to find yourself in, where you're the go-to person to put on the block. And I really think it was came down to the fact that he didn't have anyone in his corner, truly. He didn't have anyone that was absolutely going to fight for him. I mean, he had Dave on, but it wasn't the type of relationship that we see with, like, the committee, where the committee has that strong core group of six. He didn't have any of that. And I don't know why he just kind of sat back and let things happen around him right at the start and was allowing it to continue to happen as the game moved forward.
Yeah. Again, going back to what I said about season 11 having such a special place in my heart, when I heard Kevin was coming back, when I saw that on the premiere, I was cheering. It's like, yes, one of the most underrated players ever is going to get a really good shot at this game with no weird clicks or demographic twist and everything. And then, what happened, Kevin?
Mm-hmm.
I get having the initial jitters of being one of the first ones up. He starts playing from the back foot the entire time. And because of that, he really didn't have too much of a chance to do some real scheming and plotting like we know he's capable of. And part of that is the unexplored area of the old school, new school debate that the show kind of tried to play up. In the old school, things were more fluid. Things could change on a week-to-week basis. In the new school, like I said, it's get an alliance of five or six and then of all compies and just run the table and never give up power. Mm-hmm. So in that situation, he's behind an entire rack of eight balls. And he just was too set in his own ways, too much in his head to kind of work himself out of that situation. Not that he may not have necessarily even been able to, given the way the dynamics work now, but he just kind of sunk into himself and never really tried. And the times that he did, his reads were just so far off that it was saddening. I mean, as they showed it on the broadcast, the only reason he figured out that David was telling the truth about the Ian vote was because it wasn't a stupid lie. It was like David lies about things that make no sense and have no consequence. Why would he lie about this where it actually counts? Like, that's what it finally took to get the proper read. And yeah, it's like
that or a wall yeller.
Yeah.
That's true, too. Oh, he was. I just want to know who the wall yeller is. I'm very
well, there's
curious.
Multiples, but I'm you can find them on Twitter. But yeah,
Having been on that soundstage, having walked through the CBS Radford lot, I wonder where the hell these wall yellers even come from, honest to God. It's mm-hmm. like, how do they, it's like, because I don't think the stage is on the border of the studio. Like, it's people that are literally on the studio lot doing this.
I have no idea.
So I was like, especially now when production's ramped back up on the studios, but not to a very large extent. I can't imagine that there would still be that many people walking around able to shout into the place. But just like plane banners, I mean, it's something that has happened from the very beginning, and it's just kind of comes with the territory.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you know, this season, for Kevin, we didn't get the Kevin that we were talking about. We got the Kevin who told Mike Bloom in the interview that he had a lot of difficulties connecting with people in the house. Mm. He claims that he tried different angles, but just couldn't find a way to do it. And of course, we've talked previously about how the white people in the house had more of a shared cultural background, which made it more difficult for the people of color to break into their alliances. But I also question just what Kevin did to try. He said in week 6, or somewhere around there, that he hadn't really talked game with Memphis. Around the same time, Nicole said Kevin didn't like her and never talked game with her. This week, Kevin said he and Cody didn't have a good relationship and barely talked to each other. Adding that, you know, he wanted to talk to Cody about as much as stabbing himself in the eyeball. Now, none of these are signs of someone who was really trying their hardest to make allies.
Yeah.
It is very sad to see that you've gone into week 6 and you haven't even had any strategic conversation with particular people. And I get it. Sometimes you might not mesh with someone and you might not really get along with them on a personal level, but you have to be able to talk game with them. And I do think that it says a lot about the person's inability to strategize when they put that personal component ahead of the game component, where, well, I don't really get along with him, so I'm not going to talk game with him. Well, that's not going to work out well for you, especially since Cody is part of the majority alliance and Cody's head of household twice. So that's
Cody's been head of household the whole game.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So you want to talk to everyone because you want to have more than just a fleeting relationship with them. You want to be able to have some type of pull. And I think we saw this week how badly Kevin really was at strategizing when he did decide to talk to Cody went down a completely wrong path. And you were just kind of sitting there. At least I was flabbergasted that does he think threatening him is now going to be the best course of action when you're this far into the game and Cody has so much pull? So it really just all read very, very wrong. And I don't know what part of the game Kevin was just missing, but it definitely seemed like he was missing a very large component of it.
I mean, I'll give him a little bit of a pass on that conversation because it didn't go down exactly as it was presented on the show. Mm. I mean, one of the big things they cut out was the fact that Cody basically told him right to his face, "I'm putting you up." And that's what led to him saying, "What can I do to not get put up? Please don't put me up again." It's like he'd already been told at that point. And Kevin mentioned this a few times that he mentioned it in his exit interview. He's very bad at being fake with people, which especially given the click nature of his first season, that's a very surprising statement. But yeah, he was pretty much emotionally drained by the time he went up to talk to Cody. Another part they didn't show in for good reason was that when he got into the HOH room, Cody was in the bathroom and saying, like, "Hey, don't hang on, wait a minute." The door was closed, and Kevin makes this sign to the cameras, like this is going to be like hanging myself. Mm-hmm. But the other 4 times he was on the block, he was able to be calm, be collected, kind of be cool with everything. But this time, he even admits, like, "I just couldn't really hold it together anymore because it was just so draining and such a gut punch to keep going up on the block again and again and again." So I definitely sympathize with that to a certain extent. And this is one of the overall problems we've had with the show is that not just with the racial undertones of the cast, they do seem to edit the show to try to find a way to blame the black people for their own evictions. Like going back to the Davon and Bailey argument with Christmas a few weeks ago, like that was edited in a in a way, at least initially, to make it look like Christmas was completely reasonable and in the right. And it's like, no, there's a lot more nuance to this that you guys are not showing here. And, I mean, the fact that Zingbot plays right into Memphis's obsession on David by saying that you're not an all-star. I mean, Julie's exit interview with David, I'm getting ahead of ourselves, I'm sorry, is basically was like, hey, aren't you so proud that you got so far even though you didn't deserve to be here? It's like, it's maddening that the show knows what's going on and yet shows the exact wrong way to cover it. Again, Kevin doesn't get a full pass because we'll get to that in Rule 4, but I get it. After everything else that had happened to this point, I get it.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, don't discount that. I'm sorry, David. I don't discount that it was an emotional thing that he was going through. 100%. That has to be a lot. But there had to have been some reason why he continued to be the fallback person. And that was because he had a lacking part of his game, and that was anybody who was really going to fight for him. And so I feel like that's where his real struggle was, is that he wasn't finding that person in the house that was really going to fight for him. And I guess, I mean, I hate to say you have to kind of like throw yourself at the mercy of the HOH, but you kind of do in a situation like that, regardless of how difficult it might be, because that's the person who's deciding your fate. And to come at them instead of trying to kind of suck it up and just deal with it for the fifth time, which I'm sure is horrifying. It's just one of those things that, you know, at that point, yes, I understand it was probably a breaking point for him. But that particular conversation certainly did not go the way that he wanted. And he knew going into it that it was going to be a difficult conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing is that none of that mattered. I mean, I know it's we need to talk about it, but none of that mattered because he was already the target.
Exactly.
And all he did was switch himself from being 99.98 the target to 100% the target.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, yes, it is terrible to threaten the HOH or anyone and say, if I go to the jury, I'm not going to vote for you. Because as Taryn has pointed out, if you do that, well, then everybody in the main alliance is just going to believe they have to go to the end with someone else from that core alliance. Haha, you're going to have to choose. If you say you won't vote for me, well, fine. You're only going to have a choice of us two. And we did all the same things. So take that, sucker. Mm-hmm. You know, you're forcing them to tighten up.
Yeah.
And so that didn't matter. What did matter was that going back to the beginning. So we'll switch from the end of his game to the beginning of the game. When that big alliance formed, and Bill, you had brought this up, that the big alliance formed, and the people on the outs never banded together to fight it. And Rob asked him in his interview, Kevin said he was so annoyed that the people on the outs couldn't form an alliance in the beginning of the game. And he thinks some of it was that they just didn't trust each other. But then he modified it to say that others didn't trust him. Well, gee, Kevin, I wonder why they didn't trust you, since you went around completely blowing up Janelle and Kaser's games with bizarre conspiracy theories that weren't even close to being true. And you convinced Nicole A of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, his excuse at the time on the live feeds was apparently that Janelle talked down to him and Nicole A like they were stupid, as if they didn't get it. And he said he wanted to come to his own conclusions, which, quite frankly, sounds like any random conspiracy nut on the internet. Oh, don't tell me what the facts are. I'll come to my own conclusions. Well, guess what, Kevin? You were wrong. And, you know, so, yes, it's no wonder that she was talking to you that way.
Yeah. There was a lot of moments on the live feeds where I was cringing because we actually knew what was happening because we'd seen it. And then he would be talking to someone and completely flipping the script and say, no, it's something else. And you just want to jump through your TV at that point and go, no, you're so wrong right now. But everything seemed to be the wrong read for him, for sure.
Yeah. As a fan, as someone who's been trying to get on the show over the last few years, you put yourself in their shoes, and some things are just so obvious that I can't believe he missed them.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I'm not an expert at reading body language, but there were some pretty just right out there signs. And, you know, like, I don't discount the possibility that Janelle talked down to him. That's depending on the season. That's kind of in character for her. But you still kind of had to just see the writing on the wall from the very first moment. I mean,
yeah.
Right.
Again, we're talking episode two. He goes to Cody, bares his soul, and asks not to be put up, and gets put up anyway, with Cody telling him you don't have the right to take it personally, which, yes, he does, but, you know, yeah, but it's from a game standpoint, you know, buck up and deal with it. That exact moment is like, that should have told you everything you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, gather your forces, muster the Rohirrim, get this thing going. Yeah. You already have a war to fight, and he just kept reading everything wrong and just sunk into himself.
Yeah.
To the point where he left the house with a Linus Van Pelt blanket on his neck.
All right, let's move on to David here. Speaking of poor scheming and poor communication, I don't even know where to begin with David. I guess at the very beginning, because that's where he was. He had barely played an hour in his season, but he did have an opportunity to study up and get ready. He didn't take it. Mm-hmm. Ovi discussed this when he was our guest on the podcast. He tried, but David apparently didn't take any advice, didn't even bother to watch old seasons while he was in sequester for 2 weeks. When he was asked by different interviewers if he felt that he was at a disadvantage due to his lack of experience, he said yes. And I just wanted to yell back at the interview. There was a way you could have helped offset that.
Right. Absolutely. I'm still baffled to this. I love Kevin and I love David, but it's kind of like a head scratcher sometimes with the decisions that were made. And I think in David's situation, you know that you're coming into the house as someone who has probably the least amount of experience. And that is definitely going to work against you in an all-star season. There is something with having a knowledge base, not only of the game, but of the players, of the people that played previously, and having some idea of who you could be playing with and knowing what types of moves they're going to make or what they're known for. And he didn't take advantage of any of that. He just walked in like he would have walked into a newbie season when nobody knows anybody and you have some familiarity with the game. So it's really, really sad to see that that was a decision he made. And we saw it on television. He struggled with the entire game because I think of the lack of preparation walking in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the thing is, the lack of experience shouldn't damn him necessarily. Memphis's Ahab-esque obsession with him is cringeworthy in the extreme. And again, I say that sitting here from a fan and person who's dreamed of playing this game myself. I've been in Memphis's shoes. I have looked at several of these casts and I say, what the hell did you do to earn the shot at $500,000? Who the hell are you? Like, oh, hey, you're a model. You've got a nice chest. Here's everything. That's not a qualification as far as I'm concerned. I get that. But once the game begins, you deal with the person as they are, as a competitor in your game. So, yeah, it wasn't necessarily David's lack of experience that screwed him over. It's the fact that Memphis decided that that was something to exploit and punish him for. Now, we've had examples of unknown quantities doing well. The biggest one I can think of off the top of my head was Russell Hance getting to the end in Heroes versus Villains. He was the one unknown quantity to most of the cast on that season. I think Parvati knew about him and maybe a couple others, but it was right after his original season. There was only a 4-week layoff in between shooting. Nothing had aired. He was unknown. Nobody knew what to make of him other than the fact that he was a villain.
Right, but he also played an entire season before.
Yeah, so he also knew. He also watched the game before playing the entire season.
Right.
It's not a true apples to apples comparison. I concede that point, but I'm saying what Russell did right was exploit his status as a question mark.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. But here's the thing:
And David never thought to do that. He wanted to be taken under somebody's wing and taught the game, and. While I can argue against the all-star title for a lot of these players, when you have that, you can't go in there saying, hi, I'm inferior.
Well, but here's the thing, too. I do think that can kind of go both ways, where I think Memphis saw that as a chance to exploit his lack of experience. And so Memphis made a decision that I'm going to exploit this individual, and I'm going to force upon the other people in the house that they know he's not experienced. And that was a game decision that Memphis was making. So he was exploiting a situation to try to make it work to his benefit, where yeah. I don't feel like David did the same thing. Whereas if David wants to go in there and own it and say, you know what, I am an inexperienced player. And because of that, I shouldn't be a threat to any of you. And I should be able to just play this game and not let any of you really worry about me, because what do I bring to the table? So I don't discount the idea of I want to be taken underneath someone's wing, but I also don't feel like David presented it in that fashion. I feel like David was presenting himself more as, I am an all-star, and I'm going to prove to you all why I'm an all-star.
Yeah. And he failed miserably at that.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, that's the problem here. No matter what else, and I would argue that even in a newbie season, David would have failed.
Yeah.
Because in week two, Christmas asked David for his pitch, and David's response was basically, and he was like that with pretty much everyone. So what? It's funny because some people gave him too much credit, because they made the standard calculation of, if you're not talking game with me, you must be talking game with the other side about me. But the problem was, he wasn't talking game with anybody. So no. Everybody assumed that he was against them. And, you know, Kacer said that David spoke in code, and Kacer had no idea what he was talking about. He rambled about conspiracy theories and how he was going to stop them. And when Kacer asked David to explain himself, he refused. And then David would just come up with wacky ideas. Like, he told Bailey that Kacer and Memphis were in an alliance with Ian. It's like they don't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And
or
so,
he would pretend to cry about having used his own power on himself and then lie to everyone in the house about
That's rule two. You're jumping ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I can't help myself.
But no, it's like it just kept going on. It's like, he's on the block week two. Bailey and Devon are trying to save him. Devon told Nicole Anthony to her face, I'm trying to advance people who look like me, so I cannot vote out David. And then David gets all mercurial and mysterious, like, oh, well, things are going on in the works and behind the shadows. I can't tell you nothing. It's like, I was like, dude, she's trying to help you.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, you want to talk about, this is like, what was it? The next week, two hinky votes for Kacer against Janelle. Danny, oh, hey, David, were you the vote? Why would you ask me that? What's that? Is this a question? Does it have a question mark at the end? Did you lift up your inflection at the end of the question? What is the question? It's like this is so great. It's like I get trying to be a little bit unpredictable, but when no one can pin anything down other than what the hell are you doing here?
Yeah.
I don't believe David should have been on the season either. After the crap he had to go through last season, bring him and Ovi and so many others back for a second chance season. I would be 110% behind that. No questions asked. But when you decided that this should have been called All-Stars, he shouldn't have even been in consideration. But again, that said, once he's in there, you can't hold that against him and not look like an ass. We can, because we have absolutely nothing to gain or lose. But
yeah,
but yeah, it's like, congratulations, Memphis, you got your whale, but now everybody thinks you're a complete ass bucket. Forgive my language. It's like, I'm sorry.
How dare you say bucket?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think Janelle summed it up in a couple interviews, telling Mike Bloom he's terrible at the game and adding to Rob and Taryn that he is, quote, one of the worst Big Brother players I've ever played with. Now, I do have one more thing to say about David, and it's similar to the Kevin discussion we had, where we had a long discussion and then I said none of that mattered. But which is I know that some people think David's decision to take the $10,000 was absolutely terrible. And I'd say under normal circumstances, they were right. But he saw so many people who had found the correct shirt already. He had no idea, because he's David, what the proper strategy is for OTEV. And he stumbled on the prize shirt. Plus, he knew Kevin was the target, and he also knew there was no way he's winning this game. I mean, no matter what else he knows about the game, he had to know that. So why not take 10 grand? And here's the thing. Who was the most illogically, stupidly angry at him? Christmas. And I say illogically and stupidly because she would have been the replacement nominee if he had won veto. But she was angry at him. You know what? Christmas, in the two votes that David was in, Christmas voted to keep him both times. Mm-hmm. So nothing came back to haunt him there.
Right. Yeah. For sure.
The only thing I would have raised an eyebrow on was because it was the first round and he was up against Cody. So it's like there was a chance for you to beat the HOH and get yourself that much closer. But otherwise I'm 100% with you. It's like he's got no chance of winning this game unless he's up against another David, like literally cloning himself and putting himself in the final two. And even then I'm
then
only,
they'd be
yes
the Davids.
That's right.
Awesome. <Nice. laughs> but it's like, so yeah, I mean they're all getting huge stipends this season as opposed to the normal one, which I think is like $750 a week. But yeah, get your money. I was like, you are dead to rights in this game. Your best hope is to get dragged to the end as a goat. And in this round, your only chance of survival is beating Cody up any kind of physical apparatus. Take your money and run, dude. I don't blame him for a second on that. He had to do some weird damage control where he had to say that he was donating it all to Black Lives Matter, which you kind of paint yourself into a corner with that. You kind of have to at least donate something out of that now, because otherwise people are going to think you're a complete jerk. But again,
maybe he was. Maybe he was planning to anyway. Yeah, maybe he is. Yeah. But either way.
The timing, if it had been like round two or three, there would have even been the most remote raised eyebrow. But yeah, I don't blame him for a second.
Except by Christmas. Because Christmas wants to play in everything and win everything. Exactly. All right, we can move on to... On the note of, we can move on to Danny, who was, of course, the best schemer of the three. Not that that's saying much.
By default.
She told Mike Bloom she wanted to come into the season playing a different game, being in control every week. And her strategy was to plant little seeds to help her later and to stab people in the back. She made various one-on-one alliances, such as Enzo, Memphis, Tyler, and, of course, Cody. And then there was the Slick Six and the committee. And, you know, she was friends with Nicole from outside the house. She was willing to cut most anybody except Cody, who she called her BBBFF, and with whom she did all her strategizing, which obviously didn't work out so well for her.
Yeah, I do have to give Danny some credit, actually a lot of credit, because, I mean, even leaving the house, Cody was saying that she was the individual that he was most fearful of. And I think a lot of people emphasized that point as well and recognized it. Because I do think that the one thing that Danny did was she was trying to go against the grain just a little bit. You know, she was, well, but just hear me out, okay? Just hear me out, David. She knows that she's in this group of six and she wants to be committed to the committee, but she's also mindful of her own game and how she wants to be perceived if she's in the final two and how she wants people to vote. And so she and Nicole were being very similar in some of their strategies that they were following along when they would vote for certain people, because they were hoping to maybe gain a jury vote. And I know that that's something that we'll discuss later as well, but I think that that fell into her strategy as well, where she was trying to keep tabs on everyone. But unfortunately, by her trying to keep tabs on everyone, she found herself too interwoven in a lot of different stories and narratives and promises that she then couldn't keep. You know, I think Tyler is a perfect example. They basically shook on, I think it was a final four before they would go after each other. And then how long did that last for her? You know, it didn't last long at all.
30 seconds.
Right. Exactly. And so something like that certainly does not bode well for you in this game, because people then look at you and say, well, she certainly doesn't keep her word because we shook on that. And so I think it was her ideas were good. It was the way that she then carried it out that didn't work out for her, because there was too many things happening that she had to keep track of. Instead of just kind of focusing on a few things, she was getting herself involved in a lot of things.
Yeah. I've never really been a fan of Danny's, but I would argue this was her best season from a gameplay perspective. I mean,
wow.
even though it's not really her best result. I mean, season 8, she got to the end, but she was basically dragged there by her dad.
Yeah.
And season 13, I think she finished one or two spots behind where she did this time, but she played very aggressively because she was gifted the first four rounds because her dad left on like night 3. Because that was the whole twist. Like, you're in a pair, and if one person leaves, you're automatically guaranteed to the jury face. So she got to play with house money for 4 weeks. This time she knew, just because she, you know, time is a factor, literally, she can't rely on winning comps this time, even though she's, I think, tied Janelle on the veto record or something like that. So she had to up her social game. She had to play it a lot more strategically than she normally would have. And to a large part, she understood that. She had her main alliance, what she called the core four, which I just love that that's, I think, the first or only second mention of that we got in her exit interview with Julie.
Right.
Because the show was all about the committee and the Rick Slicks or whatever the hell. This is what happens when you put more time into naming the alliance than actually making sure it's effective.
Yeah.
Remember, folks, Chilltown happened organically. That's all I'm saying. She had a main alliance. She had a potential final two with Nicole. She had the larger committee alliance. Like, she was very much playing a Todd Herzog. She had layers. There were, mm-hmm. like, she had really good setups. Even willing to bring in or cast off Tyler or Devon and Bailey when the time was appropriate. The only, her big, you know, downfall really was just the fear of pulling the trigger. She had her shots. She had them. It's mm-hmm. like she had Tyler dead to rights. Yes. All she had to do was tell Nicole it was okay to vote for him, and she would break the tie. And not only then, again, this is the whole, here's the path, skew it with a move. If she does that, the whole balance is upset. And you're in the situation right now, I think there would have been 11 left at that. There were 11 left at that point.
Mm.
So, or 10 left once that vote happens. So you have Tyler, one of the biggest threats of the game, gone. Huge point for your resume. And then you have the rest of the now four on their back foot. Enzo, now that he wants to start making moves, probably would have been okay with it in the long run. And now you're the queen of a new alliance of yourself, Nicole, Kevin, Devon, and David. You're now the majority, and Ian, you're the head of it.
Yes. This is what we were saying earlier. When you have that,
they're going to defer to Danny because she saved all of their butts.
Yes. It's like that group of six. Where do you fall on that totem pole? And that's like, I think her problem was that execution component, is that she had all of the potential but didn't know how to execute it properly. And I think that's a perfect example of a huge missed opportunity for her.
To extend her own metaphor, she planted all the seeds but refused to reap what she sowed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's it would have put her from the bottom of six to the top of another six.
Yeah, I'll hit that metaphor later, a different direction. But, but you know, I mean, she could have changed things multiple times. You know, Janelle said on social media that Danny has no one to blame but herself. She targeted all of the people that would have had her back. Ian, Bailey, Kevin, Devon, Kaser. Mm-hmm. She chose to work with Nicole and Cody. And now, you know, speaking of Janelle, Danny claimed to Rob that she fully intended to work with Janelle and was shocked that Janelle mentioned her name. And she had a rule coming into the house that if she heard someone mention her name, she was going to target that person. Now, you know, these were recorded interview questions and answers, but, you know, Rob at the end questioned the validity of that timeline you know, I'm with him. That's not the way I remember it. I remember Janelle bringing up Danny before Danny brought up Janelle. But, you know, that's also right around when people started to become skeptical of what she was saying. And this is the thing. I don't give her as much credit as you do, Bill, because there were several instances when it looked like a fellow member of the committee might make a move against her. But, you know, they always somehow went for the person of color instead. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but then Danny really blew up her position by accidentally winning the HOH wall competition. It's pretty bad when you fail to throw a wall comp because literally all you have to do is fall down.
Fall.
But, you know, after everything that happened, she ended up with Ian and Tyler on the block. And that's where it gets to what you were talking about. And it was so bad because she told Nicole that Ian only had connections to the two of them. And that was the reason she used to say, well, no one will be upset, so I can nominate him. But we've discussed this before. That's the person you should keep. This is a person who only has an alliance with you.
Yes, literally, absolutely.
Literally, Enzo and Tyler were laughing at her, picking her friend Ian rather than Enzo as the replacement nominee. And, you know, I said a few weeks ago, we might end up talking about this on Why Danny Lost. So here we are.
Another peerless prediction.
Yes, exactly. So she had Tyler on the block and she had to keep her spot on the committee. She had to remain loyal to them. You know, fat lot of good that did her.
And of course, the answer is no, she didn't. It's right. Like the way that a lot of these players have psyched themselves out to be loyal to this alliance where it was just wholly unnecessary. And again, if Cody, as you mentioned, is her BBBFF, God, that's a alliteration nightmare. You can make this move. You can get rid of Tyler. You can reform the entire house and still have Cody on your side.
Sure.
It's like, I mean, that new 6-4 that could have emerged really could have been a 7-3 or an 8-2. And you could still have
the again.
And you could still have the fodder of Kevin and David if you want to just chuck them whenever you feel like it. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, this isn't forest from the trees. This is leaf from the Amazon.
Yeah.
Look at the big damn picture.
Yeah. All right. So rule one, and we're an hour in. So rule one's almost always the longest one. And I know my notes are shorter for the rest, but rule two is kind of a big one too. But it tells players not to scheme and plot too much and keep their scheming secret. So I'm going to continue with Danny here because at the beginning of the game, she said she wanted to chill and lie low early. But as much as she referenced her thoughts on having lost last time because she played too fast, she has a vastly different understanding of lying low than most people would.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were discussing, she was going around all these planting all these seeds, thinking she was a mastermind, but she was causing people to become suspicious. You know, even Julie Chen, not known for her game acumen or understanding, you know, told Dalton Ross that Danny overplayed her hand when she planted too many seeds of paranoia and doubt. And, you know, then Danny told Dalton Ross that she was playing the game by pushing, this was part of her lying low, pushing until she knew she had to back off. That, you know, she had was voted out of season 13 because she pushed too hard. But she kept saying she knew when to back off. It's clear she had no idea.
Yeah.
You know, Tyler called her extra and said she loved planting seeds and trying to turn everyone within the slick six against each other. He called her reckless and sloppy. Enzo called her sloppy. She kept doing stupid things like asking Cody to do a hinky vote with her and then doing it anyway after he said no and then claiming that it wasn't her. Like he was so dumb. And then she claimed not to have voted Kevin when everyone knew that she did, again, making people feel like she thought they were stupid. So whenever Danny would start questioning about who did something, you could pretty much guarantee it was her. It's like, who spilled the milk over there? I have no idea.
Okay, she did Danny, the same thing with the 10 grand too. Tyler. Yeah. It was the same exact thing.
Adam Klein said on the podcast last week, never tell an unnecessary lie, but she kept doing it.
Yes. Yes. And I think that Danny suffered the most from the inability to listen. I think that she was so interested in wanting to put out those unnecessary bits of information or trying to cause some commotion and pushing just enough that she wasn't listening enough. And I think that the conversations that you watch her have with Nicole, this is very evident. Nicole does a lot of listening. Danny does a lot of talking, or at least she did, you know, talking at Nicole. What do you think about this? And what should we do if this happens? And what's going to be our next move? And Nicole is always kind of just listening and going, well, I guess we're going to see what happens with the veto. And I guess we're going to see what happens if they're... And instead, you know, Danny was never in that position. When she would talk to people, there was a lot of talking at people. And I think she was doing it because she was hoping that she could maybe instill some fear or that she was going to make them start thinking a different way and that she could plant those seeds. But by doing it, all she was providing them was fodder to then bring to somebody else and go, did you know what Danny just said to me? This is what Danny said. What do you think about that? And then they would talk about it. And I think that that was a really big missing piece of her gameplay, was that just listening component.
Yeah, I agree. And the lies just became so transparent and just way too much. I mean, it got to the point, like you were mentioning, it became projection. Whatever I'm accusing you of doing, it's what I'm doing. I was like, David took money in the pudding. No, I took it. I took money. It's like, did you cast the hinky vote? No, of course, because I did. And I mean, hinky votes in general is a practice that just needs to go away, because they serve little purpose. But especially in a season like this, because, again, you've got the dominant alliance controlling all the action and the rest of the house is running around like blind squirrels. What are you going to stir up? What pot is going to get stirred by trying to pin a sympathy vote on somebody? Like, there can be a purpose to it, but not in the way that this season's right. run. I mean, there was one time where she did it the right way, and that was on Christmas's HOH, where she confronts Bailey about the Tyler rumors. Bailey does not mention Tyler by name, but she figures it out, and it becomes a case where Bailey has the truth about Danny, but Danny has the HOH's ear and goes right to Christmas and lies to her and makes sure that Bailey and Devon are the targets. It's like, that one time she did it right, and I think she just kind of got this confirmation bias that if it worked once, it's going to work all the time, and it did not.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and even beyond that, you know, before she was HOH, she would question people about why they were talking to others. And, you know, she wasn't subtle in the way she wanted to control everything. When she won her secret power, that was another screw up. She didn't use it on herself when she had the chance, but then she told a few people and then she used it on Memphis, which made her look suspicious. She should have just used it on herself and then thrown the competition correctly this time. And then she had another problem with this rule, which was that it says to avoid being in an obvious duo. Mm-hmm. Everyone knew how tight she and Nicole were, with Christmas talking about the two of them overplaying together, Tyler saying they would never turn on each other. As it turned out, Nicole was willing to turn on Danny, but people didn't believe her, and it certainly didn't help Danny. Plus, the two of them made it obvious that they were working with Devon the week before, and the more Danny campaigned to keep Devon, the more convinced other people became that she wanted to keep Devon. So it was she was just so obvious in her, all of her overplaying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, we just talked about Danny acting like she was asking about things, you know, the projection thing that you were talking about, which, by the way, I used to have a coworker who did that years and years ago. We worked on something, and then, I would eventually go tell my boss. Well, I later found out that he was claiming credit for everything we worked on together. And I found out because of him, because he was like, oh, did you just run to the boss and tell him this was all your idea? And I was like, no, why would I do that? Well, it occurred to me why he thought that, because that's what he did every time.
Mm-hmm.
Every time we had a collaborative idea, he would run to the boss and say it was his idea.
Yeesh.
So yeah, it was the same sort of thing. That action gave it away, just like Danny. But anyway, there's another evictee this week who tried that, and that was David. And of course, I'm talking about when he used his basement power on himself and then pretended he hadn't, going so far as to ask Kevin if he used it when Kevin was on the block with him.
Kevin was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Oh.
Why would I save you? Like, I would save myself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
that was bad.
And that was the problem with that sort of lying, which was that people like Devon and Kevin wouldn't believe him afterward, even when he was being honest.
Yeah.
Which was, of course, only the latest in a series of terrible over-scheming by David. It's funny. We talked about he didn't really scheme, but when he did try, he fumbled it so badly that it became over-scheming.
Yeah. He picked the wrong things to focus on.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think, Bill, you mentioned earlier the whole telling Davon that he was in a secret all guys alliance, which didn't actually exist, and saying, I can't be open about it, but I'm putting safeguards in place, which sounds like the government saying, I cannot confirm nor deny that the spy has been captured by Russia, you know?
Mm.
And then he
I
also
do not recall the things I said on tape.
Yeah, right. He also spilled all of Tyler's beans to Davon about the things Tyler had been spreading, then goes back to Tyler and admits it, saying, they got it out of me. Like, he was the spy who had been captured and he was tortured.
I know, and Tyler was like, what did they do to get it out of you?
Yeah.
Is it safe?
Yeah.
Is it safe?
Yeah.
Ugh. So bad. It was, well, and I do feel for him because it is, I think this goes back to just his inexperience with the game and his focusing on the wrong components of the game.
Yes.
You need to focus on the relationships that you're developing with the people in the house, which is inclusive of trust. And if you are giving everyone in the house no reason to trust you, when it does matter, they are not going to trust you. And we saw that exact thing happen between he and Davon when there was that whole blow up and he was being honest with her, but all of the things that he had done up to that point didn't give her a reason to believe him and trust him because he had been focusing on all of these weird things that he was being dishonest about and doing it very badly. So I think that that was what we ended up seeing, is that he was over strategizing on things that didn't matter. Like, it's your power. Just say that, yeah, I saved myself. Why is that a bad thing to do? Yes, I found it. Look at me. Give me, you know, a pat on the back. And I used it to help myself out. That's not a thing you want to hide from. I don't know why you would lie about that.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about, no one else would have used it on you. Cody pointed that on the DR.
Mm-hmm.
And if they know, worst case scenario, I hate to say this, but what I've come to call the Hellman's Alliance, because it's just straight up Mayo, they could just look and say, well, there's another minority we can put up. It's like that's their worst case scenario in that regard. Adam mentioned it last week, and it's been a through line we've repeated for years. Unnecessary lies are just so stupid. And a lot of times we can harp on the big, like, emotional, maybe even inappropriate ones in history, like season 11, Natalie lying about her age and not being a college grad, like that mattered at all. It just made her seem arrogant. Or Matt Hoffman lying about his wife's illness, you know, to the point where it's the one time I ever agreed with Rachel when she confronted him about it in the jury house. You know, it serves no purpose. I've told this to every time I've tried out for one of these shows, and it's literally my life philosophy here. I only lie in those rare circumstances where the good far outdoes the harm of being caught. $500,000 is very much a good enough reason, but I'm going to lie about what alliance I'm in or what moves I'm making, not who stole the crunch berries. You know, what in the name of all this whole
thing? That's why you're not getting cast, Bill. That's the reason right there. You know,
well, that and I keep threatening to take off my shirt. Yeah, I'm in my late 30s and overweight. Gee, I wonder why I'm not getting cast. This is the rare case where he didn't scheme enough, but he also schemed too much. And
right.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is, you have an experience, but they give you the resources to learn the game. They will give you every season of this show on DVD to study if you're in the finals to get cast. If you want it, they will give it to you. And it doesn't really take you that long to go through. I mean, hell, there are YouTube videos. My roommate and I were watching one the other day where they recapped all of season 10, the actual footage, all of season 10 in 3 hours. Like everything that mattered about season 10, every fight, every vote, every move that Dan and Memphis made, everything, 3 hours. I said at the top, I really haven't been watching the feeds this season. I still listen to Taryn's podcast every morning. I still read Joker's because, you know, shocker of a concept, I want to come onto this and at least look like I know what the hell I'm talking about. I don't want to just fly by the seat of my pants and make a complete ass of myself. I may do that anyway, but I'm not going to intend to do it.
Maybe if you cry a little bit, it would cover up.
Can you fake it?
We want some tears.
Give me a few scotches and show me pictures of puppies. It'll happen.
Okay.
Oh.
Jessica will take care of that later. She has it.
I got you. I got you.
Yeah. So let's finish up this rule with Kevin, who, you know, we've talked about a couple of people. We've talked about David spilling the beans here. And Kevin had a full on bean farm going. early on, he seemed like every time he got a piece of information, he just had to run and tell someone.
Yes.
Often the person he definitely should not have told. And,
yes.
And in this way, he was similar to Devon, but worse. At one point, Kevin was talking to a group of outsiders, and David said the other side was just plain outplaying them. And David was right for a change. And a big part of it was that's because Kevin told the other side everything that they were planning.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, part of this rule is keep your scheming secret. He clearly did not get that.
Yeah. And I feel like maybe there was this idea that he thought if I share information, I'm going to form a bond with this person and they're going to want to play the game with me. But like we talked about already, he was jumping in way too late.
Mm-hmm.
The six had already been formed. The six knew who they were. And so all he was doing was providing very significant pieces of information for that group of six. And I think his attempt was, well, I want to get in, but they didn't need him in. So it was like, all right, we're just going to keep letting him feed us information. But he doesn't know that it's just to his detriment.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was really clawing to see where could he have possibly played too much? And apart from what you guys mentioned, I really couldn't find anything. I hate making comps seem an important part of the game, but that's the best I can come up with. He overplayed comps. He lost two major comps that could have saved him because he couldn't settle for being in a winning position. He had to keep going. He couldn't quit while he was ahead. Now, with the golf, it ultimately wouldn't matter. But even that first veto, the very first week, he had that one.
Yeah.
He had that one. And he...
Let's not talk about the bananas again.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's your favorite topic, but... but no, it's the perfect is the enemy of the good. And he kept trying to be perfect in the rare situations where he got a chance to do good. And most of those were in comps. And in the main game, like, he just couldn't really get anything together. And what he did was just so off base that he just kept shooting himself in the foot.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we're going to take a quick break for our sponsors, and we'll be right back. We're back, so let's get back to the show. All right, well, let's go ahead to rule number three, which talks about the need to be flexible. Now, we've already discussed that Kevin and David really didn't have room to be flexible. Mm-hmm. Kevin, because he didn't give himself the room, and David, because he's David.
David's a bad thing now, just being a David.
No, he's that David. That David.
All right.
We don't want any self-inflicted wounds here.
That's right. That's right. But Danny could have been flexible.
Yeah.
She just we've already covered this a lot. She just chose not to be. She chose to be completely loyal to the committee. She had so many opportunities to change things, and she took exactly none of them. But I kind of feel like we discussed most of that already.
Yeah, I just think there was an inherent fear that she had about going against the committee for some reason. And I think you saw a lot of what she wanted to do when she sat down in the diary room and she talked about these ideas that she had and different things she wanted to attempt to try. But then she never did. There was an inability to execute. And I think that came from a place of fear of going against the committee. And yeah, I mean, so she had plenty of opportunities to be flexible and she just didn't take them.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give Kevin and David a little bit of credit for being flexible by necessity because they were always scrambling, because they were always in a minority position. They had to basically offer themselves up in any way they could. It obviously didn't work most of the time. With Danny though, yeah, she was the first one to at least show some willingness to turn on her own. But in the end, and this is something I took notes on every player in the game because we didn't ostensibly know who would be going out this week. So theoretically, we could have been talking about anybody. But I copied and pasted this into
very theoretically.
Yes, I copied and pasted this note into seven other players, And it's something that David taught me very early, and it's something I scream every time. You cannot simply tie yourself to one alliance and hope it succeeds!
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, for sure. Absolutely.
If I ever get on one of these shows, I'm tattooing that on my arm. I was like, or probably in a less visible place, just in case. But it's like, but yeah, I know it works more often than not in recent years because of the way the game has shifted to be more comp-heavy and more alpha-heavy. But again, there's six of you. Only two of you get to the end.
Right.
At some point, you have to take them out before they take you out. And again, Danny had it served to her on a platter. Hell, the whole house had it served to her on a platter when Christmas volunteered for the block. And they just were like, oh no, the committee is sacrosanct. And it's like, no, it's not. It's these are your competitors. You're trying mm-hmm. to beat them. You're not trying to just hang out for the summer. Like, I know in the COVID atmosphere, just the idea of hanging out with people for a while is probably enticing. But that's not what you're here for.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it worked. One person, if they want, if they play it right, can stick to one alliance the entire time if you can convince everybody else to do it too. So right. If Cody wins this season, mm-hmm. which right now it sure looks like he will, but if Cody wins this season, then yes, it was right for him to stick to the committee. Everybody else it was wrong for.
Yep. You know?
So...
Especially since Cody's number one is Enzo, the one who's technically not in the committee.
Right, yes. Which is a great point, because although you have to look at someone.
Yeah. I mean, de facto, that is a good point.
That is a good point, because Enzo is not even part of the committee, and he is reaping the benefits of working with someone who's in the committee, but hasn't tied himself to that particular group of people. So
I'm surprised they didn't name themselves the subcommittee.
give Enzo time. He'll get there eventually. You're not allowed to have anything to write on, but I'm sure he's like just scribbling alliance names on the mirror with toothpaste or something, yeah. just to keep coming up with them, because that's literally half his strategy both in every season. Just come up with alliance names. It's just God, they're all stupid.
All right, we can move to the fourth rule, which tells players not to let their emotions control them. Jessica, which of these three had the most problems with this rule?
Really? Well, I mean, it depends on what emotion you want to look at.
All
do you want
emotion.
To look at someone?
Any emotion.
Well, I feel like we've got some issues with Kevin when Kevin always looked like a sad puppy. And I think in like every instance that I saw him in the house and every time he was talking, this is tough for me.
I think I called him Mopey McMopeface.
He definitely, yeah. So I feel like he struggled a lot emotionally, and maybe that came from just because he kept getting put up on the block. But I think if we're talking about just emotional gameplay, I think I've got to go with Danny, because I think Danny made way too many decisions based upon emotion and just really was so caught up on this. I need to be strong with the committee. However, there's all of these other opportunities presenting themselves to me that could help me win, but I really like these people and I want to stay strong and true to them. And she was forgetting about the purpose of the game, and that's to win. And I got to give it to her, which is being way too emotional in her decisions. Yeah. Although Kevin looked like a sad puppy the whole time.
Yeah, I was also going with Danny, so I'll say that's the right answer, unless Bill has a good argument. Because, like you said, she wasn't just strategically attached to the committee. She was emotionally attached.
Yeah.
Friends with Nicole, BFF Cody, mm-hmm. Said she would take him to the final two, which would have been really dumb because he'd beaten her, as we were just saying. You know, these relationships were a hindrance to her playing the game correctly.
Yeah, for sure.
As far as Kevin, I can just only give one homage. So stupid. That, I mean, Kevin wore his emotions and his blanket on his sleeve the entire time.
But
that's in character for him. It really is. Mm-hmm. And even when he was in a much more powerful position in season 7, he definitely thrived on the social relationships and on the emotional connections. And at that point, it really wasn't to his detriment. And, you know, in the end, he lost on a trivia question to Jordan, of all people. But had he not gotten that question wrong, if he won that competition, he would have won the game. So I can understand it.
Well, he didn't think he would at the time. My interview with him, he says what the information he got, he would have lost. But who knows? Mm-hmm. That's a long time ago.
I mean, from what I remember on all the feeds and everything, and obsessively watching, he definitely had guaranteed votes in Michelle and Lydia. If he had taken Natalie to the end, he probably could have gotten Jeff and Jordan's as well. So I think he was in a good enough position where at least his emotional personality would not have been to his detriment. Dani, not just in her friendships with the group, because she and Nicole are friends outside the house, but she, you know, to invoke a modern reference, she had an almost Karen level of snippiness whenever anybody questioned her. And again, this is the projection of all of her seeds and her lies. It's like she's telling a lie about something that she did. And when someone called her, she's like, how dare you? You know, it's like you're totally shady. What are you talking to me for? I mean, the biggest moment, of course, is when she went out the door. We're talking, what was it, 5 weeks ago, when Kacer gives his little speech before getting voted out. She goes into the diary room and says, I've never had a bad word to say about him, but that was completely disrespectful and tasteless. And then what does she do? She tries to blow up Tyler and Christmas's game on the way out and gets so snippy about it that she not only doesn't hug them on the way out, but forgets to put on her mask on the way out. She's like that attitude about it. Like, and you know, this may be, you know, a hot take, throwing some shade, you know, gas on the fire, whatever, but she'll never admit it, but she is her dad's daughter. She is her father's daughter, and it came out this season. Not to the extreme levels of banging pots and getting into, you know, arguments with Jen like Dick did back in the day, but there were a lot of shades of her father this season, for better and worse. Because I think being a little bit more ruthless like her dad helped her game, but on her attitude and emotional level, I was seeing some dick there.
Yeah, the sound I just heard was him blocking you on Twitter.
He wouldn't be the first.
I will say, when I originally covered Kevin's season, when we originally covered it, and I wrote my Why Kevin Lost column, I said, in a season where emotional play ran wild, Kevin remained centered. So however emotional he was, at least he was not making his decisions so much based on it.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's just who he is. I think
he's a very naturally empathetic person. He's a very naturally empathetic person. And that showed through in all these, you know, these scenes that the shows have given us throughout the season of these nuanced discussions on race and identity, which are sadly undercut by the actions of the cast. But those are the moments where Kevin shines the best, because he is the most human of the group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just a slight tangent. As you mentioned that, it occurred to me, and if anyone saw me just smile and laugh, it's because I was thinking, what are they going to do now? Have two people sit down and compare to be what it's like growing up white in North Jersey versus South Jersey, you know? I mean,
wait, what about the Texan discussion?
Stupidity. So
I'm so sick of Italian stereotypes. Yo, I don't like the Italian stereotypes. Yo, no.
Yeah.
I don't like that kid.
Yeah. But anyway, I do think, I mean, Kevin was emotional in multiple ways that affected his game. He refused to work with Janelle and Kacer after the first week because he was angry that they dared to try to save Keisha instead of him. He became, like I said, Mopey McMope face when he was nominated the second time. And, you know, these things didn't lead directly to his demise, but it put him in a position where he was virtually alone for the whole game.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Didn't necessarily hurt, but it definitely didn't help.
Right.
Right.
So moving to David, it's hard for me to say how he did in this role, because we have to judge it against a baseline of how he would have played or should have played otherwise. And we've already gone over his gameplay. It's not like he would have amazed us with his strategic abilities if only he hadn't been worried about his emotions. I don't think his emotions or lack thereof helped in either direction for him, because there almost was no helping.
Yeah, he cried on cue, though. Remember, it mattered, not that it made sense, but he did cry. Yeah.
I mean, he had one emotional outburst when Davon didn't believe him,
which was totally understandable and you know, yeah. because we didn't see what else was said during on TV. We didn't see what else was said. And he had the absolute right to get that mad.
Right. But he also set himself up for that interaction in a way, because he had been acting in such a strange fashion that people couldn't figure out where he was coming from and lying about things that didn't matter, that it's kind of like the boy who cried wolf.
Yeah.
Now, if you keep doing it, then eventually when you're telling the truth, no one's going to believe you. And so I think that that bit of emotion was completely justified, but also he had kind of put himself in a corner at that point.
I mean, in a weird way, I think he was just so anti-emotional for most of the season. Mm-hmm. He, like,
you're right.
When you're acting that suspicious and stoic at the same time, no one can get a read on you. No one can figure out what's in your head. And apart from that one outburst, the only real shows of emotion were when he lost comps, and he would get, you know, ticked off. He might sulk for a little bit. Because again, he's a new school player who's taught to believe that comps are the only thing that matter, and that equals your worth in the game. So every time he lost, he was like, you know, almost like Christmas would be. But by the end of the segment, it's over. With Christmas, it carries on for 45 more minutes.
Yeah, you know? I mean, you call him a new school player, I call him a no school player. But
yeah, I mean, yeah,
yeah. Now, yeah, so you mentioned, you know, his lack of emotion and stuff. But as we move into the fifth rule, you know, we talk about how they need to pretend to be nice and play the social game. Now, the interesting thing about David is that Kacer at one point told him there's a human side of the game and a game side, and you don't need to prove yourself on the human side because people love you. And, you know, I've heard from a number of the really dedicated live feed watchers, including, I believe, Taryn, that David was fun when not talking game. And so he had some emotions. It was just whenever there was a strategy discussion, his brain shut off.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I think that just goes back to his struggle of not knowing how to best do something like that. And I think that that would happen to a lot of people. And when you don't have the experience, you don't really know how you're supposed to react. I remember the first time I had to lie on Survivor, and I was like, ugh, oh my God,
oh,
I have
please,
to lie right now.
Please, acting like she's never lied before. She's a lawyer.
I do not lie. I'm a prosecutor.
Oh, that's true.
Anyway, so moving on. Your body reacts, and if you don't prepare yourself for it correctly, then you're going to give yourself away. And I think we saw a lot of that with him, where he just didn't know how to control the uncomfortableness of the situation, and his reaction gave it away. And it's like, you know, the poker players we watch play are some of the best players sometimes, because they're very cognizant of this and they've dealt with it a lot. And so they're able to kind of keep themselves in check. And I just feel like he was someone who couldn't keep himself in check. And that's why there was this really weird, like, I don't know what's going on with him. I can't understand what he's thinking or what he's doing, because he didn't know how to react emotionally to those particular moments.
Yeah. So we're saying that David couldn't play the personal game. Got it. Okay.
I'm saying he did, actually, that he did. The social game was the only thing he did, was because that he was fun in those circumstances. It was when it left the social game. But the thing is, he wasn't playing the social game. I shouldn't say that. He wasn't pretending to be nice. He's just a sociable, nice guy.
Right.
Yeah. Until he has to think about doing something, and then it like overloads his brain.
And the thing is, he had a lot of reasons where an outburst, or, you know, just getting up in someone's face would have been justified. I mean, again, with Memphis's creepy obsession with him, any of us would have understood if he just said, "Dude, back the hell off. You know, what did I ever do to you?
What is your problem?
Who the hell are you to judge my worth?" He never did that. When Bailey and Devon got just raked over the coals by Christmas, and that entire ill-advised sequence, David was basically sitting at the counter just be like, "I'm not getting involved." And that speaks to the larger issue, because as Devon and Bailey pointed out, far too often, black women are cast to be sassy and cause drama. And David's like, "I'm not going to justify the stereotype right now. I'm not going to play up what decades of reality casting has said I should be doing right now. It's like, nope, I am staying out of this. I'm going to support my friends. I am going to try to make peace, and that's it. You know, it's like, that's very much to his credit. I think that, as you said, David, I think that's more of just a genuine aspect of his personality rather than anything strategic or part of his game. So I guess I wish that the rest of his personality was much more attuned to the game, but
right.
But it was one of those rare moments that was just truly one of those rare items that was just truly positive in his favor. That and throwing the confetti when he got the power in silence, those were the two big things for him.
Right. Which, again, that was not him thinking. That was just him acting and being excited and fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Being a person, being a human being, God forbid.
Right. Now, moving on to Dani, she told me after her second time playing that she lost her first season. So this was interviewing her after the second time that she lost her first season because her social game sucked. Now, I look back at that and I don't really, you know, remember all the details, but I have to question, considering that she lost to Evil Dick, who was, shall we say, not exactly known for a great social game. As a matter of fact, I was rereading the interview that I did with the two of them. So I did the interview together. And I asked Dick questions like, do you really think it was right to say that you wanted to choke the life out of someone or hear their bones crushing or, you know, that they, you know, I mean, these were things he said in the game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so to say that she lost because she didn't have a good enough social game and she lost to him, I'm like, are you really judging this right? But in any case, she continued that in her second season, she wanted to play the best social game she possibly could, and she knew she had to put aside any feelings about people she didn't like and put the game first. And then this season, she said in interviews that she wanted to create social bonds that would lead to strategic ones, and I think we talked about that somewhat earlier, and she felt that she did. I just don't think it worked as well as she thought, because, you know, she would talk with Nicole about how everybody was so friendly in the house, and meanwhile, other people are planning to stab her in the back, including Nicole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that goes back to her desire to really formulate a bond with the committee people, mm-hmm. the committee members, and have a great relationship with them, and forgetting that there's still a game that also has to be played at the same time. So it was like she wanted to utilize them in both respects. Like, I want to be able to strategize with them, and I also want them to be my friends. And I want to be able to have these great conversations with them about myself and my life, but I also want to strategize with them. And I think this season we've seen a lot of people emphasize that there's personal and there's game, which I think is interesting.
And game
that they're
personal.
Making such mm-hmm. yes, that there's like these divisions personal. That are being made. Yeah. Right. And I feel like she really struggled with that, because I think she thought that if I'm having a personal connection with this person and it's also someone who I'm strategizing with, well, then I should be okay. And we've made promises and assurances to each other. So I think that she just kind of got it wrapped up in each other, and she shouldn't have. You know, she needed to separate some of that. And also we saw what happened with Ian, you know, where that was someone where she did have an actual connection to, and so did Nicole, and she didn't utilize that to her benefit. And I think that we saw that with the other people in the house that she continued to let walk out the door, even though she had more of a connection with them on an emotional and personal level, but not as much of a game level. And so she decided to go with the committee where she thought there was more of an emotional connection, and there really wasn't. It was like she was building it up in her own head to be more than it actually was.
Yeah. I mean, taking it back through Dani's entire Big Brother history, she had the social advantage in season 8 because, one, her dad, and two, if you recall from the premiere, she was in the main cast that went in the house, and Dick, Dustin, and I think her name was Carol, they were upstairs in the HOH room waiting to be brought down. So as soon as Julie announced the twist that some of you know each other, you know, someone from your past, Dani was already saying, it's my dad, we haven't spoken in 2 years, we don't have, like, she got on the advantage right from the start in season 8, mm-hmm. playing the social game and getting people on her side. She lost because her dad played a better game. Yeah. I mean, it's just calling it what it is. Her dad played a better game. Yeah. And again, same thing in season 13, because her dad left the first night that the feeds came up, like literally they had been in the house for, I guess, 6 or 7 days at that point. The premiere airs, and then the feeds come up as soon as they stop the show stops airing on the West Coast. And at that point, Dani is in the DR learning that her dad has left the game. It was that quick. And right. because of the rule that if your partner was gone, you went straight to the jury phase. She had 4 weeks playing by herself with no risk to her game whatsoever to forge these relationships, both with the newbies and with the vets. And she even got her husband out of the deal. Like, she played mm-hmm. a spectacular social game in season 13. This time around, she started fine. She came in with a little bit of a mystique as being a quote unquote all-star. Basically, for a lot of these people, like, their favorite female player outside of Janelle. I mean, Tyler even said it after she was evicted, like, this is the best player I've ever played against. I mean, mm-hmm.
now oh, we'll for Tyler, get to that.
For Tyler, consider the yeah. sample size.
Damn it, you're stealing my jokes.
But because she started planting so many seeds, and because she started projecting so much with all of her scheming and her lies and her rumors, it honestly became harder for her to socialize because you're going behind everybody's back, and you're mm-hmm. and you're very obvious about it. I mean, this is what Ronnie had to deal with in season 11. You know, back then, people would criticize him for talking game with everybody to the point where once he was HOH and you know, made his decision week one to not vote out Shima. You know, you have Russell harassing him every single day, going ratty, 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 and basically locking him in the HOH room. But it's like when you're the culprit, when you're the obvious culprit, you can be as nice as you want, you can be as friendly as you want to your friends, but everybody's going to think you're up to something.
Yeah.
And yeah. because of that, it just grows the target on you and puts you further down the pecking order. And I think that's why Cody and Enzo really didn't have a problem voting her out. That's like what Dani said to Julie that hurt her the most, that it was unanimous, that not even Cody voted to save her. It's like because she had done so much as far as just sneaking around that she became a liability.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Now, in Kevin's interviews, moving on to him, he called out, you know, the friendliness that she was talking about. He called it out as fake, which is what it really mm-hmm. was, which is why he also said, why would I want to go hug these people? I've had enough of their fake hugs. And it seemed like he just couldn't go with the flow of that fakeness. You know, I mentioned earlier that he told Mike Bloom he had a lot of difficulties connecting with people in the house, and it never really changed. And he admitted to Julie that he's awkward and has difficulty communicating his thoughts without coming across as being strange. You know, as a specific instance, he said he felt like he still didn't know Cody or what to say to him, and considered Cody intimidating. Though Kevin admitted that was his own baggage he was carrying, because he was never a cool person. And it's hard to have conversations with other people who are perfect and nice. So, like, Jessica, I don't know how you manage to have a conversation with me every week. You know, I'm looking at that.
It's a struggle.
Yeah.
You saw me before my setup. I'm like shaking. I'm getting sweaty. Right. Like, I can't do it.
Yes.
You definitely affect me every time. Yes. So, yeah. It's very, very difficult.
And I empathize. I was a bullied kid growing up. I was awkward. I was social. I was antisocial. I still am. I'm sure that there are people watching this right now going, who the hell is this dork making these horrible jokes? I get it.
No.
It's part. I've come.
How dare they say that about Jessica? Oh.
You're just on tonight, aren't you, David?
It's a process, you know, and there's.
Lost my microphone.
There's a lot that goes into anxiety, and everybody experiences it differently. I experience it differently than Kevin does, but sometimes I mean I've been in and out of therapy for years. There's stigmas around it that need to go away, but it is very much, you know, walk a mile in their shoes kind of situation. And it was one of the, like I said, if I had been cast in season 11, I would have taken Ronnie's spot, and I would have just hung out with Kevin and Lydia the whole time. And I would have moved to LA so much faster so I could hang out with them in West Hollywood and just party with them. It's like those were my people. I would have been put in the brains click, but I would have been with the outcasts, or the offbeats, sorry, as they were called. you know, poor Casey and the banana. But yeah, I get it. And that's why that first week, Kevin bares his soul to Cody, says, I'm feeling awkward. I'm feeling vulnerable. I'm sorry that I haven't been as social with everybody, but I'm getting a weird feeling right now. It's my hang up. I understand that, but please understand it and don't put me up. And then Cody put him up anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, Cody not only put him up, but had the audacity to say, you're not allowed to take it personally. It's like everybody takes it personally. Like you're telling them that I'm trying to take $500,000 away from you. It's like, I can respect it from a game perspective, but don't tell me that my emotions don't count. And I really don't think that Kevin ever got over that.
Yeah.
And I do think that someone like Kevin can thrive in a situation like this by having that type of personality. And he attempted to. He put it out there. He did have that conversation with Cody, because I think it's one of those things you have to kind of own about yourself. If you know that about yourself going into a situation like this, it's better to kind of put it on the forefront. Let people know that it's a thing, that it's a factor, because it might work to your benefit. Unfortunately, I think he was in a position where the six had already come together and it didn't matter at that point. So he could have said any number of things and it wouldn't have changed the course of the game, but at least he tried. And right. I think that people need to recognize, if you have those qualities about yourself, you shouldn't shy away from them when you're introduced into a new group of people. Because it can certainly work to your benefit, because it can help people understand you. And also it can help you connect with people, because sometimes you might make an assumption about someone and you could be completely wrong. And having that conversation might actually forge a relationship you never expected. So he tried. He certainly tried to put it out there. So we have to give him credit for doing that. In this particular game situation, it didn't do him any good.
Yeah, he's a naturally friendly, lovable person. Even when he's targeted, even after Cody put him up, they made peace. They apologized, because there were some weird emotions going on. We were both in the wrong. It got out of hand. I'm sorry. I'm still, you are my target, but as a person, I still love you and respect you and everything like that. I get it. It was hard. I mean, I think back to season one. Like if season one had the same rules that today have, can you imagine a situation where Eddie, the eventual winner of that season, goes to like Will Mega as HOH and say like, hey, you can see I only have one leg here. I'm not that confident in my abilities and comps. And then he gets nominated and says like, well, you can still play for the veto. That's the equivalent of what Cody did to Kevin week one. An emotional and self-confidence level, it's just crushing. So you know, credit in the world to Kevin to even attempting to come back from that.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, the sixth rule warns against being too much of a threat. And continuing with Kevin, he came out and joked to Julie that he was voted out because he's a threat. Then he acknowledged it wasn't true. And indeed, you know, he was the nominee 5 times and he wasn't evicted until the 5th time. Which indicates he was a good pawn and nobody was worried about keeping him around. As he told Dalton Ross, the others most likely thought there would be no repercussions if they put him on the block, which pretty much means he was the lowest person on the totem pole of the whole house. That was a good read by Kevin on that one.
Yeah, he read that one correctly, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The only thing threatening about Kevin that I saw was that Cody figured Kevin would be the only one who would potentially put him up against Enzo if he won HOH. And, you know, I think that's the only time that Cody's worried about being voted out. And he was probably right about that. But that was literally the only threatening thing about him.
And I do think that that's a great point in a game like this, because you have to be mindful of if that person becomes HOH, who are they going to be targeting? Mm-hmm. And if you know that you are someone's main target, that certainly makes that person a threat to you personally. So it changes the dynamics of the game, because the HOH has so much power. It's not like you have to bring a group of people together to formulate a vote. It's one person who gets to decide who the house is voting against in regards to two people only. And so I do think that that is a perfect read as to why his threat level was significant to Cody, but not necessarily to right. other people in the house.
And here we thought Ian was the ultimate pawn. But
no, Ian thought he was the ultimate pawn.
Well, Julie told us he was totally. Yeah. But in this one matchup, Kevin was in fact the bigger threat, not just to Cody's game True. Personally, but because since the Alliance finally had the splinter, there were different factions that wanted to weaponize David. It didn't work out because Memphis was literally the only one who didn't want to use him, and he won HOH. But between the two, David still had some use to some people, Kevin didn't, and the threat to Cody's game is real in the sense that Kevin was at least mildly competent in competitions. Like I said, he almost won that first veto. He was in a winning position before he screwed up that golf HOH. He did win a different veto. It was like, he has shown that he is capable. And as the numbers dwindle, that capability can turn into legit threat status. So if he had survived this triple eviction and was in the final six, I would give him better than 1 in 3 odds of winning something and turning the tables. So much better odds than I would give David in this situation, because the only thing David won was one power in the dark that was literally blind luck. So. So from that standpoint, yeah, if I'm anybody, not just in the Alliance, but even Enzo's, like, between the two, Kevin is the bigger threat.
Right.
Was he a threat in the grand game or to win the game? Hell no. But at least in that week, he was the bigger threat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Moving to David, speaking of him, you know, I guess I will let our first guest and Kevin's old housemate, Ronnie, your substitute, sum it up from Twitter.
Where
he said, "Don't feed me any crap that David was the bigger threat over Nicole. There's no way to defend this eviction."
Mm-hmm.
And he's right, of course. Nicole is by far the bigger threat, meaning, okay, that's not why he was evicted. You know, David actually told Mike Bloom that he purposely played up not knowing the game because he didn't want to be a threat. And he certainly accomplished that, if nothing else.
Yeah, I don't know if that worked to his benefit, really. Yeah. It really didn't.
I mean, what? Like I said, I think Dani improved her previous season's position by 1 or 2 spots by going out third in this week instead of first. But of course she didn't improve overall because she's been to the end, but Devon improved her previous best position by making it one more vote past the first juror. And David improved his previous finish by being in there more than an hour. Yeah. So yeah. I was like, and again, that's not his fault. That was just some complete BS twist that was thrown right. at him, and he was the victim of it. We can make an entire second chance season just with him and Glenn and Jody. Just
I don't think Glenn's coming back.
But you take my meaning,
right?
So he improved his position just by existing,
right?
But he was never a threat to do anything.
No,
he was never a threat to win anything. He acquitted himself all right in comps. Not to the extent where anybody would really think he was going to go on a run. But he didn't embarrass himself to
mm-hmm.
But again, his threat status is his mercurial nature and his weird conspiracy theories and never being able to truly be straight with people. But yeah, between him and Nicole, what the hell are you people doing?
Yeah.
You have a guy whose previous finish is improved by his mere existence and a winner.
Yeah.
A winner, by the way, that I called this is the one Big Brother winner I've got, like, and I called it in the audience. This is true. I'll give a slight tangent for an anecdote. I went to the live eviction, Victor's second eviction that season. Dan Woolman, one of the EPs, the one who actually says, "Please come to the diary room." That's his voice. He came out to greet us all before the show started. And he polled the audience. There was about 20 of us. It's a very tight space. It looks way bigger on TV than it actually is. And he polled us as to who we thought was going to win out of the, I think, 7 that were left at that point. And Victor got a couple of claps, even though we all knew he was being evicted, because we all knew he was going to go right back in. Most of everybody went for Paul because Paul was playing the better game and he was the audience favorite at that point. When he asked who was if Nicole was going to win, I was the only one who said it. I was like, I was the only one. It is on tape. Call CBS.
There's proof.
Call CBS. Give them the roll of tape. I am the only one who called Nicole winning. But again,
that's awesome.
But again, winner against newbie. What? Again, yeah. I know Memphis wanted him gone, but Memphis has the biggest blind spot in the world when it comes to David. And again, David was useful to all sides potentially once the group had to eat itself. And Nicole is a past winner. What the hell?
Yeah, what it showed is that no matter how many times Enzo says, yo, man, come on, man, let's play the game, man, yo, what he really means is, yo, I'm going to sit on my butt and do nothing.
It sounded like use these floaters. Don't even worry about it. We got to take out the big players. We got to take out the threats. I vote to evict David.
Yeah. And I do think that it's interesting to look at the difference between someone who comes with kind of an army behind them, someone like Danny, who that could be viewed as someone who is a definite threat because they're clearly running the table, right? I mean, they're making all of the decisions and they're deciding who's going home and who's going to go on the block because they're winning the comps. And so that brings to it its own threat level because it's not just you. It's not just about Danny. It's about Danny and all of the people that come behind her. Whereas, you know, Kevin and David, they didn't have that. So you can look at it kind of both ways. They're not threatening because they don't come with an army, but at the same time, they could be threatening because they are a floater and they could be scooped up by someone to be used. And unfortunately, I think David and Kevin both missed that aspect, and they tried, but it was you were trying against, you know, a force of six, and they were too late to try to do that.
Yeah.
And so they could have utilized that to their benefit and then become a threat because they were not tied to the six, but they would have had to have tied themselves to another group, which they didn't end up doing. Right.
I mean, I can see it from the standpoint of because they knew it was going to be a triple, even before the stupid screens behind Julie went off. Maybe Cody and Enzo were thinking to themselves, at least in the moment, hey, only one of us has to go tonight. You know, if we keep David, that means two of us have to go. It's like, and we've already taken out Nicole. So it's like if she doesn't win HOH, we can put her right back up. Maybe that thought crossed their mind. It would have briefly crossed my mind if I were in their shoes. I still would have voted Nicole out without a moment's hesitation. But but I can at least see that as maybe giving it like a micro nano chance of considering David a threat.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Now, moving on to Danny, if we let Tyler beat the judge, Bill, you've already brought this up. She's like the best player I've ever played against in my life. And, you stole my joke because it could be technically true because Tyler didn't exactly play against Big Brother super geniuses in his first season.
Well, you're saying Sam wasn't an all-star.
He was more of an all-star than some of these people. But
Sam's robot was an all-star.
Yes. Oh, sorry, wrong Sam. I was thinking of last season Sam, not two seasons ago. Too many Sams. I mean, here's the thing. Well, I will say, I'm not going to recover what the whole group on the recap podcast did because they discussed why it wasn't really the case. And for one thing, if she was that good, Tyler wouldn't have known about all the moves she was trying to make.
Now,
I will say those moves were indeed threatening to his games. Mm-hmm. So he was correct to target her. Just don't call her the best player. Unless he wasn't being truthful, he was just telling the other players that, and this was an excuse to do it, but it wasn't true, but she was a threat to him.
Yes. And that goes back to the same point you made before,
right,
that if you are someone, you know, where Kevin wanted to put Cody up on the block potentially, then that makes him a threat to Cody. So we have the very similar thing here with Tyler because they did make a Final Four deal and then she pulled back on that almost immediately and put him on the block. So I think that Tyler saw her as a threat to his own game. So it was a smart move for him to try to combat her putting him up first.
Yeah. I can definitely see Tyler just kind of saying that for the sake of the cameras, because just like with Nicole playing up the acting with Ian and everything, like these people do know they're on a TV show, and those who study the game know the timing of the live shows. So they know that once Danny comes out of that house, the screen's still on them for a few seconds before Julie talks it while they watch her picture gray out. So he knows Danny hears him say that, even though she's out of the technically out of the house. So I'm certain that at least crossed his mind to a little bit. And as far as Danny's overall threat level, I mean, she apparently had her pair with Nicole, and she had her core four with Cody and Enzo. It's like she had her deals and her sub deals and everything else. But because she kept planting those seeds, because she kept being too obvious, you always have to wonder where her loyalties lie. And in a weird X factor for this season, not only is this alliance winning everything, they're winning it by default.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas won her entire HOH week by default.
Yes.
Danny
won
her.
It's just like her first season.
Danny won her HOH because she couldn't quit fast enough. There are so many random ways outside of skill that Danny could have gotten into a power position to target him, and she'd already taken the first shot and missed. I was like, you gotta take the chance when you have
right.
it. Like he's
right.
Tyler's the only one who has literally thought to himself, I have a chance, I gotta take it. And
yeah.
and, right. and this is also why if you go on Joker's updates right now, consistently for like the last several weeks, Tyler is the only active player in the top five as far as fan ratings, whereas the bottom four are Danny, Nicole, Memphis, and Christmas. In yeah. some order. I was like, because he's the only one that we know when he gets the chance, he's going to take the shot. It's like, even though it was kind of lame to go after Janelle and Kacer because they were already in a back position, he still said, like, hey, they are still big threats. I they're outside my alliance and they're big threats. Let me take the shot. I'm going to take the shot. Bye-bye, Janelle. And then, and this time around, it's like, I get this HOH, this 1 hour HOH, and I get the veto. Danny's coming after me. Bye bye. It's like he's the one who's going to take the shot. That probably makes him the biggest threat going forward. But it definitely speaks to Danny's personal threat to him and her overall threat to the game.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the seventh rule, we're in the home stretch here. The seventh rule says,
so close.
Yeah, says to trust almost nobody. Let's continue with Danny here because she said she trusted Nicole 100% due to their friendship outside the house. And we already discussed how, you know, she would have taken Cody to the final two. Meanwhile, Nicole was plotting against Danny, and then Cody surprised her. I just got a weird error on my computer. Hopefully we're still going here.
Yeah.
Nicole was plotting against her and Cody surprised her by, you know, booting her out the door. Now I saw the Nicole stuff coming a mile away because there was a scene early on where Danny made a comment about having 100% trust in Nicole. But then Nicole, we saw saying that I'll go as far as I can with Danny. But I noticed right yeah. away, and I think I tweeted at the time, she didn't say till the end, just as far as I
right.
can.
Mm-hmm.
So Nicole was definitely not as dedicated to Danny as Danny was to her.
Yeah. And I think this goes back to what we already talked about with Danny's like belief that the people that she was playing with in the committee really had her best interests. And they didn't. They have their own interests. And that's what they were focusing on. They weren't focusing on her and all of her running around and saying things to people and planting all of these seeds certainly didn't bode well for any of them. So even though you might think you've got this very strong number two, when your number two doesn't agree with it, it's certainly not going to set well, especially when you're sitting next to them on the block.
Yeah.
So I do think that, you know, that Danny certainly found herself in a difficult spot there.
Yeah. I mean, she didn't really trust too many people, but she was also the least trustworthy person in the house.
Yeah.
Apart from maybe David, just by his weird slinking around. But yeah, it's like she did trust Cody to her detriment. She did trust Nicole to her detriment. And mm-hmm. in a weird way, there was no better scene of this than right before the vote. I mean, Dani was already packing her things the day before because again, they knew it was a triple, and she's like, I know if I don't win in one of these HOHs, I'm going. So I was like, she already kind of knew her number was up. But that moment right before the vote, where she's in the bedroom hugging Nicole, like that was the moment, because they're crying, Nicole's crying, go after Christmas first, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, I seem to recall a certain someone saying, teach me how to act. Teach me how to make sure to hug Ian and make sure he thinks I'm on his side. I was like, if Nicole was not on the block, she was voting Dani out too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now David didn't go quite as far as Dani in his trust, but he did trust Tyler, thanks in part mm-hmm. to the OV connection. And while I do think Tyler helped him at times, it wasn't enough to say pull him into the committee. But Tyler did risk his game several times when David screwed things up. So I can't really blame Tyler for finally, you know, just letting David go.
Mm. Yeah, I do think that there was a lot of second chances given to David mm-hmm. where people wanted to utilize him in a way that could have furthered their individual games aside from being part of the committee. But David was too much of a wild card. And I think that when you present yourself as a wild card and people don't really understand where you're coming from or what you're trying to do, then you become more of a detriment than a help. And because it's just an unknown, like, I don't know what David's going to do because he doesn't really make much sense. So, yeah, that's OK. I'm not going to trust him as much as I want to. And I think we saw that with quite a few of the players where they thought that they were going to be able to utilize David. And Tyler was one of those people that thought he could. And he realized, I just have to cut ties with him because I can't anymore. And it's like you keep trying to give and what you're getting back is not being reciprocated. So, all right, we're done with this because it's not going to get me where I want it to go. Yeah.
I mean, David didn't really trust too many people, but where he did, it was misplaced. I mean, And I say misplaced in the sense that he messed it up. It's like Tyler trusted him. He betrayed Tyler's trust. Devon and Bailey trusted in him. He betrayed it. He kept trying to mend fences, but messing it up along the way. And the one time, and even despite that, they kept fighting for him. Devon and Bailey kept fighting for him. Tyler, mm-hmm. Tyler still voted Nicole out, hoping to use David down the line. The only time we saw David truly give up his trust to somebody was at the worst time possible, where he believed Memphis's stupid deal.
Yeah.
It was like the deal that would have sent him out the door had Tyler not interceded on his behalf.
Right.
I was like,
yeah,
complete misfire there.
Yeah. All right. Well, finally, I don't think Kevin trusted anybody too much, because that would imply that he thought he had a true ally in the game. And he really didn't. I mean, other than maybe Devon, but I don't think he had a problem.
Yeah, no, I think he created a really close friendship with Devon. Right. But yeah, I don't think there was an issue of overtrust or anybody trusting him too much either.
Yeah, I mean, if there was trust with Devon, it was too little too late at that point. Right. They were already so far down the numbers, it wouldn't have mattered. I mean, he trusted Cody not to put him up the first week. See how that worked out. He trusted Nicole on the Ian vote. See how that worked out. He trusted his own gut instinct. See how that worked out.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
He trusted himself too much. That was the problem.
He did. Yeah. That was it.
All right. Appendix A deals with the jury phase of the game. Earlier, we discussed how Kevin's jury vote threat was a bad idea, although he was the target anyway, so it didn't matter. Besides that, I do think, Bill, you may have mentioned some jury implications, but I don't really think there were many. I do think the committee knew that they couldn't bring either Kevin or David to the very end, because there might have been enough vindictiveness among the jurors to vote for Kevin or David to win, as shocking as that would have been, especially for David. But that's about all I have for this appendix.
I think what's interesting and what people are probably considering at this point is the jury is going to be mostly full of committee members, right? I mean, that they're going to be a very large chunk of the voting population on the jury. Yes?
I think it'll be about half and half.
Yeah, four and five, basically. Or five and four if Enzo's in the final two.
Right. So that's got to come into your mind a little bit when you're deciding who to cut and when to cut, because these are people who are now going to be on the jury, and these are people who you've been scheming with all along. And so I do think that could have some effect on the order in which we see everybody sent out of the house. And I think that Danny being the first of those individuals sent, they can all argue it makes sense and they can all justify it if she's when she's sitting in that jury house and if she's giving them a hard time. And Tyler already kind of leading with, you were the most threatening person I've ever played with, or the most, you know, scary person I've ever played with. So he's already kind of planting those seeds. So I think they're all going to be doing that as we move forward.
Yeah, among the three ousters, Tyler has the best chance of getting Danny's vote in the end because he basically said it's a gay move and it's respect. It's you were coming after me. I have to make the move first. Whereas David, Memphis has no chance of getting David's vote in the end. And Memphis even said that if David got to the end, the only way he was going to get his vote is if he somehow said, surprise, I'm actually a Big Brother expert and I played dumb the whole time. And here's the receipts to prove it. Kevin threatening Cody's vote. I believe him when he say he's not going to vote for Cody, but he said that to everyone. So it kind of holds no weight. I think Cody could just say, hey, I'm good sacrificing that one vote. The one thing I kind of worry about, Danny said this a few weeks ago. I think I want to say week two or week three, when there was the first slight hint of a crack in the alliance, and she said something to the effect of, you better not send me to jury because I will poison that jury. I will be the queen of poisoning that jury against whoever I want to. So I don't think she'll poison them against Tyler because I think she'll respect the game move, but I can easily see her trying to poison against Memphis or Christmas.
Yeah.
All right. Well, with all that said, we're at the end here. So, Bill, we'll start with you. What are your final thoughts about these three? All my jokes.
Obviously, we got more game in this one episode than we got the entire season to this point. And even then, it was kind of a letdown because the first two were the ones that we all knew were dead to rights anyway. So, that said, I do like Kevin and David as characters, and I do know that Kevin is a capable game player. He just wasn't able to do it for whatever reasons this season, as we've gone over. Danny acquitted herself well, and she went out at the right time. I think it was a little bit lame to basically repeat HOHs and vetoes for the triple. And people lied to me about Will. I was like, I wanted a week of Will, damn it. Like I said, this is definitely going to be a down season. But normally this is the part of the jury phase where the best moves happen. So, Taryn and others have complained, you know, it's like that we're missing some major gameplay points by doing the triple now. But the way I see it, this episode doing it right now, one, it cuts the field by a third and gets us closer to the end. And we, even if it was planned for this exact date from the beginning, it forced the issue and finally got us to the point where we actually have to do something. It has been so depressing to see nothing happen week to week, to see the racial stuff going on, to see the show constantly protecting Nicole's
image
and reputation when it very much should not be at this point. But I will say that when we finally got the game in the last hour, I felt like I was watching Big Brother again. So it took way the hell too long, but I do have at least some hope that we're going to have a satisfying conclusion.
Now, I won't spend too much time because I'm pretty sure David wrote his final words last week when he predicted that these were the three people that were going to be going home. So I have a sneaking suspicion we're going to get an earful from David because he was prepared for this. But I will say this. I do think that we had three people go home this week that, although two were very expected and Danny was the most expected of the six to go home, we did get to see a lot of incredible play because it happened so quickly. And that was a fun thing. It was a nice change of pace. And we did at least get to see some moves happening at a very fast pace. That being said, it was rather predictable at the same time because Kevin has been put up. This is his fifth time. David was someone who'd been put up multiple times, and Danny was clearly on the outs with her committee members, even though she might not have seen it that way. So I don't think overall this was a big shocker for anyone this week to see that these were the three people that got sent home. It would have been great to have someone win an HOH and throw things off and mix things up a little bit. But unfortunately, that's not what we got. What we got was a lot of more of the same. The same people winning the comps, the same people winning HOH, and the same people being put up on the block. And now we have Danny and Nicole to add to that. So I think overall, their reasons for going, we've been talking about every single week. These were the targeted group of people who were being continually targeted. And we've now seen Kevin and David evicted. And now we've got Danny to add to that because she was a low man on the totem pole in that six. So I will see what David Bloomberg has to say about all of this, because like I said, I think he's very well prepared for this.
Yeah, I did not start writing it last week. I was not that confident, believe it or not. There were times, in my Survivor career, in my Reality News Online career, where I would tweet out and say, I have already started writing why blank lost for this person, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to say something, a few things here that are probably a little bit controversial. And I'll start with all three of our evictees this week have one thing in common. None of them were strategic masterminds this season. Yes, I include Danny. She thought she was, as she planted more seeds than a farmer in the spring, but she failed to follow the proper guidelines about spacing out those seeds so they don't grow too close and intertwine. On top of that, she overwatered, flooding the house with stupid and unnecessary lies. We mentioned earlier that Adam Klein said in the podcast last week to never tell an unnecessary lie, but she kept doing it and never realized how much it hurt her standing. In the second rule, I said Danny wasn't at all being subtle in the way she wanted to control everything. But the fact is, she wasn't subtle about anything in this game. She claimed that her plan was to lie low, but if she thought that was lying low, I'd hate to see what going full steam ahead would have looked like. David was in many ways the opposite of Danny. Yes, he also told unnecessary lies, lost the trust of others, but it wasn't so much he was playing too hard. It was that he had no clue how to play. So he was fumbling around in the dark, metaphorically this time, as opposed to literally in his first attempt. Kevin was trying to scheme and plot, but he just couldn't form relationships. Some of it goes back to the racial reasons we've talked about previously, but a lot stems from Kevin's own behavior. He admits he was awkward and couldn't connect to others, and we saw how he blew up any chance of outsiders getting together with his ridiculous conspiratorial attacks on Janelle and Kacer. Yes, that was a long time ago in the game, but it set the stage for the committee to rule everything. Danny was a loyal member of the committee, and she would not waver. When she had the chance to get rid of Tyler, she took out her friend and ally Ian instead. She thought this loyalty would get her further in the game, but instead it was rewarded by being the first person voted out from the alliance. All three of these players failed to realize that they were being pitted against one another early so that they would vote out the others before everyone could band together to support one another. In one way or another, each one of them was promised a higher position with the all-powerful core alliance, and each of them was lied to. But they chose to believe it until it was too late. Kevin and David knew it was coming because they eventually figured out their positions in the game. Danny had no idea. And she put herself on the outs just as much as the other two were. All three were out-strategized by a wide margin, and each contributed to their own undoing. And that is why Kevin, David, and Danny lost.
Round of applause.
You always wrap it up so nicely.
Thank you. And speaking of wrapping things up, okay, we're over 2 minutes, 2 hours and 15 minutes. So let's speed through.
We have to tell Adam he's now lost the leading.
Well, it
for
took
the
a triple to get him knocked out of it.
It did.
You know?
That's true. It is a triple. Yeah.
So I do want to mention that although the rules are different for Survivor and Big Brother, behind me, there,
behind me too.
And behind
that's
him.
That's right. I see it behind you.
Is a great depiction of the Survivor rules drawn by Eric Reichenbach. You can get the 11x17 version, the one Bill has, at tinyurl.com/DavidRulesPoster2. We also have another way to get the rules, so you can always have them with you. And that, of course, is T-shirt form. Just go to robhasawebsite.com or robhasapodcast.com. Click on the merch link near the top. Now, I also want to encourage people to check out the RHAP patron program at robhasawebsite.com/patron. Once you join, you'll see all the great perks Rob has for patrons, including tons of opportunities to interact with Rob, both on call-in shows and like the five-hour one he did this past Friday, or the weekly call-ins before each eviction episode, plus the Facebook groups and more. But Before I tell you about the Facebook groups, I want to tell you about a different Patreon program, because Post Show Recaps, which is the RHAP Universe's friendly neighborhood scripted television podcast, where they're talking about all kinds of different movies and shows, hosted by Josh Wiggler and friends, the Post Show Recaps roster includes Down the Hatch, a weekly spoiler-filled Lost rewatch podcast, Everything is Super, a weekly podcast about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and other superhero movies and shows, Aang in there, and Avatar, the Last Airbender rewatch podcast, and much more. Post Show Recaps will hit its 7-year anniversary this coming January, and ahead of that, the team have finally launched their own Patreon effort. Perks of being a Post Show Recaps patron include access to the patron-only podcast feed, which features a brand new movie club podcast called Post Show Recaps Theater. There's also the Post Show Recaps Discord server, where you can talk with the hosts directly about your favorite shows, as well as other listeners in the Post Show Recaps community. You can get all of the great Post Show Recaps content free at postshowrecaps.com and by subscribing to the network on your podcast app of choice. And if you like what you hear, you can get even more content by becoming a Post Show Recaps patron at postshowrecaps.com/patron. This was an effort. I'm trying to subliminally get across the term Post Show Recaps.
Post Show Recaps.
Yes, Post Show Recaps. So Post Show Recaps doesn't have a Facebook group. You get to the Facebook group by RHAP. You know, and there's a big overlap there, but they have a Discord. So does RHAP, right, for that matter. I'm just not there nearly as often. But you can also, in addition to the postshowrecaps.com patron, you can go to Rob Has a Website.
Post Show Recaps.
Right. You can go to robhasawebsite.com/patron. And, of course, once you get to the Facebook groups, make sure to say hello.
Whew, take a breath, David. That was a lot. And listen, you can also follow us on Twitter. I won't have as much to say about Post Show Recaps, but you can follow me here at JessicaLewis89. David is at David Bloomberg. And then below us, we've got at William Hammond. So
William
you should follow
J.
all three
William
of
J.
us. Oh, my God. I didn't even see that. William J. Hammond. Yep. I apologize. I have terrible eyesight.
It's how I saw my name.
I've been staring at a screen for a very long time, and I'm kind of like this at this point.
I have that effect. So,
you know that's going to be that's now going to be the cover photo for this. Yeah.
I know, right? Wait, let's see if I can do it like this. Can I make one eye go the other direction? Did I do it?
All right. Now anybody who has followed this, I guess they're going to watch to the end if they've made it this far.
I just broke my microphone again. At JessicaLewis89, at David Bloomberg, and at William J. Hammond. Follow us all. Get all the great content of everything that we post, whether it be Survivor, Big Brother related, and all the other good stuff going on in the world. Good stuff, right? 2020. It's been great.
Oh, yeah.
So there we are.
Yeah. So, Bill, where else can people find you and other things you're working on?
Okay. So we already plugged the Twitter at William J. Hammond. I also occasionally am a guest writer and podcaster with Get Behind the Rabbit, Behind the Rabbit Productions, and the No Rest for the Weekend podcast, where we talk about independent film. I have my own blog, actuallypaid.com, because I actually paid to see this, where I do movie reviews and Oscar coverage and movie news. It's been a bit lacking, obviously, this year. And if nothing else, you can see my work right now every Thursday on NBC with The Wall. That's one of my current gigs. I write for The Wall. I write the trivia questions. It's one of the thrills of my life is working in game shows. NBC just announced that we've been picked up for season 4. We're airing the back half of season 3 right now. Nice. We started the writing process a couple of weeks ago. So that's a lot of fun. There's also several shows on Game Show Network. If you watch, you won't see my name in the credits, but I write for those as well. So, Masterminds, Catch 21, Get a Clue. Those are the shows I kind of work on at the moment, and I'm always looking for the next thing. So who knows? It's a weird cliche, but I'm living the dream right now. So
that's amazing. So. Good for you.
All right. So we need a hashtag. And earlier, from the very beginning, we talked about planting seeds and too many seeds. So I think one of those.
I got a funnier one.
Yeah, funnier one. Go with the funnier one then.
Well, it's not appropriate.
Oh, well,
but
then don't
it?
Go with the what, inappropriate.
What was the way you said? I see some dick out or something?
No.
Enzo's putts? No. I
see some dick? No, I don't know. There's something about dick.
You were talking
I'm
about
sorry.
Evil dick. Let's get that clear here. Yes.
I got
us rated R on YouTube. Thanks a lot, Jessica.
You were talking about evil dick. Yes. It was funny.
I got a few here that I've been writing up over the course of the week. Let's see. Mo Money, Mo Posturing. Where's Will? Post-show recaps. I mean, wait.
Oh, no, yeah.
Post-show recaps.
But the one I think we should go with, because I will not do justice to this, but this was the greatest moment. Julie Chen, totally bogus. Yeah. It's a microcosm for the whole season. Totally bogus.
Well, that's what I said on Twitter. I just need that so as an overlay so I can use it every time there's
That's my hashtag for this week, for this season, for everything. Totally bogus.
Totally bogus. What the heck? Let's go for it. We'll do totally bogus. All right. Excellent. And of course, there's the hashtag for this podcast overall, YXLoss. Everyone should make sure you're subscribed to all of the RHAP Big Brother podcasts at at robhasawebsite.com/BB podcast or on your favorite podcatcher. We're also on the reality TV wrap-ups feed. So if you subscribe to that feed, you'll get this, our Survivor podcast eventually, and much more. In 1 week, we'll be back here to discuss Big Brother again with another great guest. Don't have an announcement yet, but promise it'll be great. He or she will be great. So be sure to tune in for that.
And we want to say thank you to Scott St. Pierre, who does all of the editing for us here on Why Blank Lost, both the audio and video version. So thank you, Scott, for all of your incredible work that you do. Also, thank you to Will from America, who created our theme song that you hear on the audio version of Why Blank Lost. So you can go there, listen to it, and then you can come here and see our pretty faces. So thank you so much, both of you, Scott and Will, for all of the incredible work that you do. And thank you, Bill, for joining us today. That was super great to have you. And you have now taken the title of the longest podcast with us. You stole it from Adam Klein, so you can say that you have now beat Adam Klein in something. So congrats to you for that.
It'll be the only context where that is true. Thank you, guys. Thank you guys so much for having me. This has been an absolute thrill, and I feel closer to the show than I have in a long time. So this has been... this has been such a highlight. Thank you guys so much. And thanks to everybody who listens and everybody else who's involved in the podcast and at RHAP. This has been just the best.
Good. Thank you
again. And, you know, thank you for all your work back on Reality News Online, too. So it was good to relive some of that.
I really do. I miss it.
I know. Me too. But I don't miss getting up at 5:30 in the morning so I can post the daily live feed recap. I have to admit that
I do not miss. Yeah.
So with that, we will see Jessica and I will see everyone in a week. Bye.
Bye.
If you lost Big Brother and you're feeling down, David and Jessica will turn it around. They'll break down the rules and they'll show you how. You played yourself and got voted out. This is why Blank lost. And this is why Blank lost.